started the time is now 8:33 a.m. on September 2nd, 2022, and I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologists Examiners to order. This meeting is video hosted using Zoom. The public and parties on this agenda have been properly noticed of this fact and have been supplied with meeting access instructions. I do want to make just a quick announcement that the state websites are down this morning, and so we are sharing the screen so that individuals attending the meeting today do have access to the agenda as we work through agenda items. Ms. Pohl, will you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Mr. Dinar? Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Dr. Malott?
Present.
Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Dr. Stewart? Dr. Stewart? Mr. Wynn?
Present.
And I'll try again. Mr. Dinar? We have 7 board members present. We do have a quorum.
Thank you. Please note that the times stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of one agenda item, proceed to a timed item, and then return to the former agenda item at a later time. The board may also reorder non-timed items. The board encourages everyone in attendance today to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You will find the link on the meeting agenda that is posted on the board's website, or today. you might have to wait until Monday to access that link, and we do apologize, but do try. And if during the meeting there's any information about whether the website is back up, we will let everybody know. Otherwise, we would appreciate the feedback, but it will have to be done perhaps on Monday. All right, I want to recognize all of the board members for your hard work. Each board member spends many hours preparing for each of these meetings. We do appreciate all of your time and your effort. I also want to acknowledge the board staff and our attorney for their all of their guidance and their continued work preparing us for these meetings. Attendance at the board meeting is eligible for continuing education credit if it is at least 4 hours long. Should its duration be 4 hours or more, please make note of the code words provided throughout the meeting. To report the code words to the board staff for the purposes of earning continuing education credit, when the website is up, please look for the link on the board meetings page for this particular meeting. It is possible that today's meeting will not be the 4 hours in duration, and if that is the case, we do thank you for that understanding. We'll now move to the call to the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board will limit the number of persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any public comment matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. Pursuant to ARS 30-431.02H, the board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or with the members of the public addressing the board. The only option available is to instruct staff to place the topic on a future agenda, if applicable. Those wishing to speak, please unmute your line, state your name, and I will call on you.
I'm KF.
Hi, KF. You may go ahead and provide your statement.
I am the former patient of Dr. Bigler, and I have a very short statement today.
Did you do that when we discussed Dr. Bigler?
I'm sorry.
Hold on just a second, KF.
Dr. Bigler's on the agenda.
Yes, Dr. Malott, this would actually be better fit in the call to the public because okay. This is not a party of the complainant in the complaint.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Thank you. Sorry, KF, you may proceed.
Okay, I gave a detailed report of the harm done by Dr. Bigler. It complete with evidence, complete with concrete evidence like audio of full sessions. I gave a statement in the last meeting, the CSC screening, and gave a very vulnerable statement and shared some very personal information detailing exactly how I was harmed. And I was startled and very confused at the recommendation by the CSC. But most upsetting was that there was no acknowledgement of the harm done whatsoever. I've listened to dozens of these proceedings, and I've never heard harm not being acknowledged. And I've pretty much tormented myself trying to figure it out, trying to understand how I can make truth be known, how I can show what really happened. I feel like I'm taking crazy pills, honestly. Anyone who actually listened to the session audio from February 9th knows that this was not a therapeutic technique, that this was erotic countertransference, which is normal, which can be normal and can be handled appropriately. Unfortunately, it was not handled appropriately. The countertransference was not what harmed me. What harmed me was all the lies and the slander against me that were compiled in order to discredit me and to basically paint me as a very unstable person. That was deeply, deeply damaging. I have pretty much made myself sick trying to understand, trying to figure out how to convey the truth. And what I came to was that I cannot, that I do not have control over this. There's nothing I can further that I can say, but what I can do is I can choose how to proceed. And what I choose to do, I would like to speak to Dr. Bigler. Dr. Bigler, I forgive you. I want to tell you that I forgive you. And I forgive you for myself so that I can move on and I can hold my head up and maintain my dignity and proceed with integrity. And I can leave this behind. I want you to know that I forgive you and I wish you well. And I hope that you choose to bring what is in the darkness to light so that you may have peace. But regardless, my message is one of forgiveness, and that is all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, KF. We will now move to agenda item number 5. Or I'm sorry, is there anybody else that wanted to make a call to the public?
I have just a quick suggestion, Dr. Davis-Wilson.
Yes.
If both staff can click on that arrow in the middle, we don't need to look at, so the screen can be a little bigger, the text. We don't need to look at the right column, create PDF. That can be minimized. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. Dr. Wilson, is this the time where I state my case against the therapist?
Ayo, we will get to you on that agenda item. I appreciate you asking, but we will be calling on you at a later time.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Hearing no other calls to public, Ms. Galvin, agenda item number 5 is the board council's update. Do you have an update for the board?
Nothing at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Galvin? I have just one. Ms. Galvin, we did hold another meeting, an emergency meeting, that the matter was to go to formal hearing for Mr. Siplinski. Do you have any updates on that one?
The order for summary suspension was issued to him, and the complaint and notice of hearing went out, and the hearing has been set for September 26th before an administrative law judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other questions for Ms. Galvin? Hearing none, we will move to the consent agenda. Are there any recusals from the consent agenda? A board member may request to remove an item from the consent agenda for independent discussion and action. Are there any such requests? If there are no requests, we may move into a motion. Is there a motion to approve this agenda?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion carries.
We note for the record that Dr. Stewart joined. I don't believe Mr. Dinar is on.
Thank you. I would like to actually take a moment to move to the applications on the agenda. Let me pull that number. If we could,
Chair, we definitely have time to do number 14.
Okay, thank you.
If Dr. Myers ready.
If Dr. Myers, if you could get ready, we would like to see agenda item number 14. This is for the EPPP retake request and the additional materials that we requested from Dr. Huerta. Dr. Meyer, can you please provide us a summary on this case?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Huerta has taken the EPPP multiple times, has not passed. He's submitted several study plans. The most recent one was very brief, and the ART committee requested that he provide a more comprehensive study plan, which he did, as well as he reports that he is now consulting with another psychologist to help him study for the exam. So at this point, he's met the requirements to retake, and I would make a motion that he be allowed to set for the EPPP Part 1.
I'll second that motion.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Do we have any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. I just had my document close out on me, so I am trying to open that up. I apologize. All right, I will actually open it up in just one moment. The time is now 8:45, so we will move forward with, or 8:47, so we'll move forward with our timed items. We will start with item number 7, agenda item number 7, discussion, consideration, possible action on the acceptance of a proposed non-disciplinary letter of concern for Dr. Luke Bigler. Dr. Malott, you are the lead on this case. Can you please provide us a summary?
Yes. During the last complaint screening committee, the committee reviewed and did considerable questioning of Dr. Bigler regarding the complaint that was brought before us by his client. We reviewed Dr. Bigler's notes at length, which included some of the interactions that happened between Dr. Bigler and his client. Following our intensive discussion, the committee came to the conclusion that it would have been appropriate for Dr. Bigler to seek additional consultation. We made the recommendation to move it to a letter of concern. He's done, I think, considerable PD as well. So that's what you have before you, and that needs to be approved during the full board meeting. And the committee did do an extensive review. We heard earlier from the client, and we listened to the tapes. There were many, many tapes. There was a lot of material, and that is our recommendation to this full board. So,
thank you. I am going to ask that if you are on the call and you're not speaking, if you could please mute your line. We are getting some feedback.
Madam Chairman, I do see Dr. Bigler and his attorney, Flynn, carry on the line. I don't know if you want to give them the opportunity to make a statement.
Yes. Thank you. I was still working on uploading that document again. Mr. Carey and Dr. Bigler, if you would like to please introduce yourself for the record, and if you would like to make a statement at this time, now would be do so.
Thank you, Chair Davis-Wilson, members of the board. This is Flynn Carey, counsel for Dr. Bigler. And if you want to just announce so the record has your voice.
Good morning, members of the board. Thank you, Ms. Wilson. I'm Dr. Luke Bigler.
And Chair Davis-Wilson, I do have just some brief comments, if that's appropriate at this time.
Yes, thank you.
This is a case in which, you know, obviously the client, former client, has a perception that is much different than what was determined by Drs. Malott, Dr. Stewart, and Mr. Dinar in Complaint Screening Committee. KF's position is there was erotic countertransference, but there's really no evidence to support that. Unlike a lot of cases, the CSC had an opportunity to read a variety of communications and listen to sessions. And KF herself acknowledged in her documentation and in the way she communicated time and again that she had been warned about boundary violations. The record is very clear that Dr. Bigler had given her warning upon warning about proper boundaries. And KF has acknowledged issues with navigating proper boundaries. There's a statement that KF made, which she wants the truth to be known, and she has concrete evidence. But I think the CSC reviewed and Ms. Michelson used the board's subpoena power in a manner that I think it normally does not need to use. But she did use the subpoena power to get records from a variety of places, one including mobile phone records that disproved that the texts that constituted supposed concrete evidence were accurate. There are many instances in the investigative report where Ms. Michelson demonstrates that there are inconsistencies between the materials presented by KF and what was provided by Verizon, a third party that has no dog in this fight. I think Dr. Malott alluded to this, but it was a very extensive CSC. It was extremely detailed. Dr. Malott and Dr. Stewart particularly went into great detail, including looking at specific pages and specific documents and very, very thoroughly questioning Dr. Bigler. I think also, as Dr. Malott alluded to, Dr. Bigler did complete 36 hours of continuing education. 24 of those is in the PBI Ethics and Boundaries course, which is generally considered the gold standard. It's what the medical board and the DO board use for ethics cases. And it allows a provider to prepare what's called a protection plan, which is essentially a risk management tool that they will use for the rest of their career. Dr. Bigler is also now in a consultation group where he can staff complex situations with people, because that was one area that I think was well received by the professional members of the CSC, that when you are a newer licensee, there is value in your colleagues and especially the ones who have a lot more experience. And so I think he's done the things that are really required here. We think that the LOC is appropriate. You'll see that it is already signed by Dr. Bigler, and we ask that the board vote it as the resolution of this case.
Thank you. Board members,
could I make one more comment, Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Yes.
I do appreciate KF being present at the last meeting and speaking, and we did take all of her statements, and in fact, I even commended her during that meeting regarding her insights and openness. So just wanted to state that for the record.
Thank you. Board members, do you have any questions for Dr. Bigler or his counsel? Hearing none, we will move into deliberations. Dr. Malott.
I think at this point, since we are, the item is to kind of vote in the letter of concern, I'd like to go ahead and make that motion that we approve the letter of concern as stated.
I second that motion.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
Would that include vacating the initial review?
Yes.
Hearing none, we can go ahead and vote. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Oh, I apologize. Any opposed?
Be sure you're voting so we can hear your vote, please.
I'll do it one more time. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. Dr. Bigler and Mr. Flynn, thank you for joining us today. KF, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate your time and your comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we have confirmation the website is back. So I'm happy to keep the agenda up, but if there are no objections, I think it might be less distracting if I stop the screen share and allow the public to access the website.
Thank you. Is anybody opposed to that option? Sounds good. Ms. Pacnon, and then I will also just add that for the CEs and the surveys, again, that will be located on the board website as well now that the website is up and running. Thank you. I did also get my document up again that closed down. So I do want to, as we move into agenda item number 8, which is also a timed item, just note that the board may vote to go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A2 to review confidential records, including the receipt and discussion of information or testimony that is confidential by state or federal law, and or ARS 38-431.03A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. So we move into agenda item 8. I am recused from this matter, so I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Davey. For the sake of time, I am going to leave but stay in the meeting, and so I will need board staff to still text me as I will not be able to hear that this item has been completed. Dr. Davey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Agenda item 8, I'm the lead on this case, previously reviewed by the Committee of on Behavior Analysis at its meeting on August 26th, and I'll provide a summary of the committee's recommendation to the board. Again, this is item number 8, discussion, consideration, and possible action related to the Committee on Behavior Analysis recommendation regarding the following complaint and initial case review, complaint number 2226 with regard to licensee Jessica Marshall. The complaint was filed on March 29th, 2022. The complaint maintained that a functional behavior assessment, an FBA, was completed and was not completed in a professional manner. The complaint also suggested that perhaps there was some improprieties with regard to the LBA understanding who was the client or acting in the best interest of the client. the licensee responded with with some excellent information for the committee to take a look at. The committee, over the course of the review, went through records obtained from the licensee's previous employer. We went through the client record, looked at informed consent, the actual FBA that was conducted, along with the recommendations that were in question, reviewed the client's IEPs, as well as multiple email chains between the licensee, her team, and the school in the school in which they were working with. We also reviewed multiple lines of the BACB ethics code, as there was a suggestion by the complainant that perhaps there had been violations of those codes. And that is where we, that was kind of the documentation that we went forward with. At the end of the day, the committee felt as if the FBA was done appropriately. Many on the committee said maybe they would have done one or two things differently, but there was nothing there that rose to a statute or rules violation. And so the committee is requesting that the full board dismiss this complaint. Board members, do you have any questions for me that I can answer at this time? Be happy to do that for you. No? All right. Next, we'll hear from Complainant SM if she's in attendance today. I've toggled through my screen. I'm not sure I saw SM.
Do not see her present, Dr. Davey.
I'll give a 3 count to see if there's a response. All right. Then we will assume that SM is not here. She was informed that this was going to be heard today, and she was present for the complaint screening. Ms. Marshall, I see that you are present along with your counsel. Do you wish to make a brief statement at this time?
Good morning. This is Artie Eves. Good morning, members of the board. We don't really have anything to say. We made a statement at the committee, which I think was sufficient. Ms. Marshall is certainly here and ready to answer questions if anybody has any for her.
Thank you. Board members have any questions for Ms. Marshall? All right. Hearing no questions, then I'm ready to make the recommendation that we accept the CBA's recommendation to dismiss this complaint. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you for that second. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all in favor. Or do we need a roll call, Ms. Galvin? We do not, do we? Nope. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstaining? All right. Motion unanimously carries. Thank you very much, Ms. Marshall and your legal counsel. Appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
And with that, I will relinquish my chairperson duties back to its rightful owner, Dr. Davis Wilson.
We will now move to, that did conclude, right? I'm not just chiming in.
Nope. Good. I already gave it back to you. You're here.
Okay.
You're right on.
Perfect. I was like, it was silent. So I think I'm supposed to be speaking right now. Thank you. All right. We will move to agenda item number 9, discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to initial case review of, starting with complaint number 22-25, Dr. Ambrosia. Dr. Malat, you are the lead for this case. If you could please provide us a summary.
Okay, I'll be glad to. Just give me, I exited out of all my documents, so I have to find the email. Okay. Okay, I have my notes, so I'm just going to go ahead because it's refusing to open up. Hi, this is regarding complaining, Dr. Ambrosia. The complaints screening committee did review this case in detail, and then the motion was to forward it to the full board. Dr. Ambrosia was a part-time adjunct faculty at Golden Gate University in California. She is licensed both in California and with SciPath in California and Arizona as well. She lives in Arizona. She was teaching courses for the psychology department at Golden Gate University since fall 2020. AL was a student in her classes in fall 2021 and for that year. So this was his third, three semesters of taking classes. AL is a complainant who indicated that Dr. A made advances on AL despite it being of different sexual orientations. There was dual relationships, shared clinical personal information with the department chair, provided AL with medical advice. And the other thing that he mentioned was the long conversations they had with each other. Dr. AL did file a complaint against Dr. A, which was dismissed. This is through the university and other processes, not this board. So during this course of these this class and the relationship between AL and Dr. Ambrosia as the faculty member, AL did come under investigation due to certain conduct at his internship site. He was terminated from his traineeship. The GGU or Golden Gate University wanted him evaluated before he was readmitted. And at that point, all the university provided guidance to Dr. Ambrosia, and all communication ceased between Dr. Ambrosia and AL. Consequently, AL has filed a complaint with this board regarding the dual relationships. And I'm going to stop right there, but that kind of gives you the summary of the case. We do have, as you can tell in our files and in all the materials, we have all of the text messages, many, many, many pages, which I reread in preparation for this meeting. We have prepared, obviously, for the CSC, but I reread. Some new information came to light since the CSC and this meeting, and that is the messages from between Dr. Ambrosia and the department chair. The CSC wondered whether the relationship, because Dr. Ambrosia is not teaching anymore for Golden Gate, and so we wondered whether that there was a problem with that relationship. However, we now have evidence that that relationship, Dr. Ambrosia chose not to teach because of her schedule, and the department chair and she are in really good standing and really wanted her to keep teaching and felt that she'd done an excellent job. So I'm going to pause my comments at that point.
Thank you. Do any board members have any questions for Dr. Malott? Thank you. We will next hear from complaint AL. AL, I understand that you are here today. If you would like to unmute yourself and make a brief statement, please also only use initials, but do introduce yourself. So you'll just use AL, but you will state your name for the record, and then you may make a brief statement at this time.
Yeah, I just listened to Dr. Malott, and there are some things I need to clarify there. Dr. Ambrosia was not in good standing with the school. I settled with the university at a settlement, and they refused to include her in the settlement because of the damage she had done. So let's state that for the record. Now, whether they're saying now that they would have her back or she's in good standing, that's something new to me, but that's not why she's not teaching there any longer. I have never filed a complaint with her at any place else except for California and your board, but not at the university, because there was no one to file a complaint with. They were lacking staff. There was no student affairs director. There was no one to file a complaint with. And when I did try, the rebuttal was to her superior, which was giving her he was giving her supervision for a group that she was running at the university with his approval, but he acted as her supervision. So she was going to him and telling him about things that were being said in the T group training. So I just want to set that record straight. Dr. Ambrosia caused me so much damage. I recently just returned to university because of all the trauma that was caused by Dr. Ambrosia. I was assigned at my new university a woman advisor. I had a traumatic experience. She told me she found me interesting and she wanted to be my advisor. And I thought, oh my God, here I go again with another instructor who was trying to get into my personal life. And I had a complete re-traumatic experience. It was happened again. There's no one ever in my school career, through all my degrees that I have ever had an instructor who spoke to me 4 and 5 times a day. She held a position of power over me. If I didn't call her, she told me that I would not make it through school without her. She had convinced me that I was no good without her. She went every day. I had to put up with her phone calls and her texts out of fear of not passing her classes or she would do something detrimental. She has been very punitive. And she only stopped talking to me after I told her I needed to get away from her. And that's in the text. I told her I needed to cocoon. I needed to get away from her. I needed a break. And this made her angry. And then she went to the school and she turned on me. Now, I be honest with you, I never wanted to. I'm gay. I never wanted to spend to 1, 2 o'clock in the morning speaking to a woman on the phone about bric-a-brac. I did not, but I had to. I felt really obligated. She had convinced me that she was, quote unquote, going to be my mentor, but I never asked her to be my mentor, and I never had it. I just never asked for any of the things that she was giving. She was doing dream analysis on me. She asked me about my whole family. She knew everything. She became very controlling. And what's so funny about this whole situation, one of my assignments in her classes was the shrink next door. If you all are familiar with that, she basically was the shrink next door. She started that T group training. There was no students who replied to her email to join her class. Not one student. She sent me out to recruit all the students because I was very popular. And when I joined her group, I understood that she was not culturally competent. She knew nothing about Black people. As a matter of fact, she called her car that was Black, Blackie. I told her it was racist to call a car Blackie or use the word blah, blah, Blackie at all. So I was teaching her about everything to do with African Americans, i.e. I'm Black and gay. Okay. So in the class, she was not competent. I was going to leave the class. 3/4 of the group said if I leave the class, they were going to leave the class too. This upset her. This really extremely upset her because she was no longer in power. She wanted to be, I guess, mama to us all, or she thought, I mean, but my situation with her was beyond the pale. There's never in my life have I ever had a woman try to get so close to me, knowing my sexuality, and sending me pictures of Black slave men embracing, you know, the girl with the she superimposed a picture with us Black slaves embracing the girl with the pearl earring, and Jean-Michel Basquiat is my favorite artist, and she's just writing me, telling me that's her fantasy, and she was sending me, she had me give her a nickname, which I had. She lived in Arizona, so I called her Cactus Flower, and every morning I had to deal with her love messages of sending me a picture of a cactus flower with a description of its beauty and all these things. I don't know what to say. I just need to say that she has caused a lot of damage. I am really uncomfortable being with women now. I'm afraid. I really am. I had to change my advisor at a new prestigious university because she was a woman. And I felt like the same thing was going to happen again. I'm traumatized by her. And last time she had arrived with her attorney and they said, did she ever have sex with me? I never said she had sex with me. She lives in Arizona and I live in California. She was having sex with me, erotic thoughts and talks via the phone, via text, via pictures. So it was never sex one-on-one because we were in two different places, but I'm not alluding to it. You have all, I sent you everything that I had, And I even have witnesses I could provide. But no one's asked for me to provide them. So I leave it at that because I'm really just upset with the whole fact that she could think that she can do this to people or to me. And I'm probably going to be traumatized behind this probably for quite some time. I never was going to report her. I had two therapists who told me that that the school supplied, they told me that I was fine and I can go back to school. And he said that she crossed every boundary possible, every ethical boundary possible. And I had another one that I started seeing on my own that I went to. He told me you need to report this. So I didn't report this immediately. If you note the dates and times, I waited 6 months actually before I filed a report against her. So it wasn't something I wanted to do, but I was so messed up behind the situation that was my only recourse, So with that, I'm done. I'm sorry if I sound erratic. This is very a hot topic for me. She's not innocent.
Thank you, AL. We appreciate you being here. Board staff, board members, does anybody have any questions for AL? Hearing none, we do have Dr.
I'm sorry, I have one question.
Yes.
AL, was at any time, was she ever your psychologist? Was the whole time she was your instructor, is that correct?
She was my instructor, but my pseudo-psychologist. She was acting as a psychologist without my knowing. She had manipulated me on many of occasion to do things that.
All right, that's my question. Is just what so, but there was never. I mean, it was
no.
a documented relationship as a psychologist. Is that correct?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a question,
Dr. Katerina.
AL, I went through every one of those text messages. It took quite a while. I think there were many, many. I noticed on the phone records, I looked at every one of those. There were many calls on both sides, even late at night. Are you saying that you had to make those calls or she would become angry?
You're absolutely correct about that. I did not initiate them. You'd have to go through it. She would send me a text, "Are you free?" She knew it was COVID. She knew I couldn't go anywhere. She knew she had a captive audience. So if I did not answer her, I would suffer some damage the next day or the following day saying, "Well, you know, if you don't want to talk to me," she'd get angry like she was a jilted wife or something. I could not have any peace at all whatsoever. I couldn't even do my studies. So yes, I made phone calls to her when she texted me and her text would be, "Are you free? Are you free?" And she knew I was free. If I didn't answer her, there were repercussions I would have for not answering her.
I did see also terms of endearment that you used toward her. I can't remember right now. And I heard her call you Shoe, my little cabbage. But I did wonder about, there were many things you seemed to offer, like poems and pictures, videos. Did you also feel that you had to do that?
Well, it's not that I had to do it. She is the doctor. She had warped my mind into thinking I don't know. I had lost control. It was as if she had done brainwashing on me. I had never had a relationship like that with a woman. As I stated, I'm gay, and I don't know. She played this role of mother, psychologist, all these things that I was not used to. And it took a long, if you notice the period of time we were together, it was a little bit over a year, but yeah. She gradually had brainwashed me. I don't know any other word to say but brainwashed, but she had played games on my mind, with my mind. And I mean, down to gifts that she was sending me as well. So I reciprocated, yes, but it was not a love. She had convinced me that I loved her, that I cared for her. She convinced me of that. But that's not the case, because when I finally took that break a year later, I said, I need a break. I started to put the whole picture together, and it was not pretty at all. But again, I waited to report it because I didn't want to be punitive. I didn't want to, I needed to think the whole thing through and get it straight in my mind.
So she did, I mean, at one point she said, I'm interested in you. And you said, I don't swing that way. And she said, no, I just mean as a friend. Did you believe that?
No, I didn't believe that. But eventually I came to believe it, because you can't talk to somebody that many times a day and text and not become involved in some sort of relationship. Now that I look back, I'm actually drained from that. I still am. I'm still recovering from the whole experience.
You've been in therapy since, or have you?
Yes. Okay. And I was not kicked out of school. I was asked to leave because of things that she said, because she felt as though when I asked for a break between she and I asked her, I need a cocoon, which is a word that was invented back in the 80s. And it means to just cut yourself off from the world, because it was so dramatic between she and I that I had, well, at least from my part, I felt it was. And when I drew back from her, she thought to herself, oh my God, he's probably going to go and say something to the school about my relationship. And she panicked. So she went, and she was already angry because I wanted to leave her group, and I didn't want to take any more classes with her. She was furious because other students looked up to me more than they did her, and they would have followed me. And this is not, she wanted to be all things to us, but primarily me, because I had great relationships with people. So,
I just have one quick question. So if you could like enumerate how this has damaged you, I guess emotionally, you had to change schools, is that correct?
Yes.
And you had to give up or not work with a particular advisor at your new school. Financially, has there been an impact?
Oh my gosh, yes, I couldn't work. I couldn't do anything. I'm going to be really honest with you. 2 weeks ago when this advisor told me she was going to be my advisor as a woman, I actually couldn't go to school for a week. I had panicked. I wanted to check myself into a hospital because I thought, oh my God, here we go again. The professor said she found me interesting. She would love to be my advisor. And all I heard was those words, and she wanted to meet with me via Zoom. And I thought, oh my God, here we go again. I've been traumatized. I'm in classes with women that I feel so uncomfortable being there and so afraid to speak up and talk because of this situation. Dr. Ambrosia would go to other students and tell them my personal information and tell them how she felt about me. Hence, she was trying to circle carriages against me. It was not a teacher or professor-student relationship. If it was, I've never seen one like that. And I hold two masters and I hold two other degrees. I've never seen anything like this. And I was only gullible because of COVID. If COVID wasn't happening and I wasn't stuck at home, I'm in San Francisco and I couldn't escape. You know what I mean? She knew my routine. She knew my dog's name. She knew where, I mean, she, I, it was, bad. I know. Yes, I'm trying. I can't. I'm really afraid to deal with middle-aged women. Yes, I am. I have to be honest with that. I'm traumatized by it. I
thank
am.
You. Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Are there any, Dr. Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, AL. How many classes did you take from Dr. Ambrosia?
Well, I took two classes in the beginning, and she was not called back for the summer session. So she was calling me every day saying, oh, they don't.
Wait, just a second, please. So could you just specifically tell me when and which classes you took from her?
Law and ethics was my first class.
And that was when?
The very first semester, which we would have to have been fall 2020.
I thought I saw spring 2020. Is that not right?
It could be spring.
No. Okay. No. Sorry. You're right. Fall 2020.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry. And then you took two more classes with her.
The next class after, psychodynamics. And that's where she started the dream interpretations on me. Then she wasn't asked to come back to the university, but she was still calling me every day. And she was very angry because the university had not asked her to come back for summer of 2021. Okay. She said, why don't you just ask your boss why they're not allowing you to come back? She goes, no, I'm not going to do that. She had a huge pride thing. She had invited her boss and she got the job for the summer.
Hey, just a second, please. If you could just answer the questions that I'm asking. Thank you.
All right.
When did the first interactions start that you felt were beyond just a student and professor?
The first semester.
In fall 20?
Yeah.
Okay. And when did you first become concerned about those interactions?
Well, I'm going to be candid. When I first became concerned was when in summer of 2021.
Okay, so
I started to get my landing gear down. And I understood what was happening, or starting to understand. Or I didn't understand, but I knew something bad was happening, was going on.
Okay, so so you didn't feel uncomfortable with any of it during the academic year you were taking classes with her?
Yes, I did, but I felt obligated. She was treating me like her teacher's pet, if you will.
When did you first feel uncomfortable with the way she was interacting with you?
I think they're on a tri-semester, so that was fall. Spring of 2021.
Okay. So during the fall 20,
that was just the beginning.
Professional student faculty relationship?
No, not at all. But I don't know. Let me explain to you. When you're a student, you have a teacher take a professor who takes a notice of you. You feel honored, right? At least I felt honored. And you know, she was a psychologist. This is what I'm going to try to be someday. And I felt, but COVID plays a big role in this. I was the captive audience for her. And maybe she was bored with COVID at home. I don't know. But our relationship was never, probably, I'm telling you, the beginning of January 2021 was when it got really enmeshed.
Okay, thank you. And so, when was your last interaction with her?
Well, I got suspended from my university because I had an altercation with another student. That was what happened at my university. Nothing else happened with regard to my needing to take a break and all this. What happened was I had a altercation with another student in a class where there was an argument. That's how I got suspended. And the last time I spoke to her was the day that I was suspended. She had not spoke to me. I had been emailing her for 2-3 weeks and with no reply. The night before I got suspended, a classmate of mine called me and told me that Dr. Ambrosia told her to contact me and tell me that she is an employee of the university and she has to keep her distance. And I said, why would she go through you to tell? I was so perplexed. So then the student was saying things to me the same way Dr. Ambrosia would say. So I knew if this was real. So I contacted Dr. Ambrosia and I texted her and I said, thank you very much. I got your message. It's been really a lot of fun and good luck or something to that effect. So the next day, I still didn't know I was suspended. It was a suspension day. I got a phone call from her approximately 11 a.m. in the morning, California time. And she was telling me that she loved me and don't say anything regarding our relationship and that she has no control over about what's to happen. And I still didn't know I was being suspended. But after she called me, I was starting to know something bad was going to take place. Anyway, she started to attack me, telling me, oh, I overthink things and da da da. She was going off her rocker. And I said, please just be kind. Please, I don't need this right now. So anyways, we hung up and an hour later, I got the letter from the school.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. No further questions.
Ms. Shreve?
No, I don't have any questions.
Absolutely. Does anybody else have any questions?
Okay. All right. I remember my question. During the time when you were a student, just to confirm, you did not, did you talk to the school about the interactions that you were having with the instructor and that, did you explain that any of you felt uncomfortable? At what point did you bring this to the attention of the school?
I said this earlier, I'll try to say it again. Golden Gate University was going through some financial issues, huge ones. They had no dean of student affairs.
So just, I know, I'm just so.
There was no one to complain to.
Okay, that was my question. I just wanted to.
They had no staff. They were short on staffing. They had no one to complain. There was no place to go except for the department chair. And that was who was her supervision for a T group training she was having for my class where she reported back to him or private information.
All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Thank you.
Any additional questions for AL? Hearing none, we do have Dr. Ambrosia and her counsel present today. Could you please unmute yourselves, state your names for the record, and now would be a good time to make a brief statement. As a reminder, we are using initials only for complaints and minor children, but that's not pertinent to this, but please be sure to use initials only. Thank you.
Good morning. This is Artie Eves. I represent Dr. Ambrosia. She has a prepared statement, but I just want to make a few comments addressing some of the things that AL said during his statement. The issue in this case really revolves around a class, maybe a couple of classes that were very difficult for a lot of the students who were participating, it seems, including AL. It was a class on multiculturalism. You'll see from our response that the texts we provided you, the text and the communication really seemed to ramp up when that course was taking place. To put it bluntly, AL was confrontational with people in the class. There were a lot of problems. He told you here today that he was ultimately suspended because of an altercation he had with a student in class. There was a lot of conflict in that class. It's a difficult time to be teaching a seminar-style multicultural class. There were a lot of students who were upset with AL. And those students were making complaints about his behavior. He went on and his behavior became irrational. Ultimately, he was suspended, as he told you. Never did he contact anyone about Dr. Ambrosia or any complaints about her. Not once. He said today there was no one to complain to. He didn't have any problem getting to the dean of the school when he wanted to make civil rights complaints, to complain about the school, to complain about others. But today he tells you there's no one to complain to. I understand his frustration and I don't mean to demean him in any way. But I have to point out some inconsistencies. She was, I think that the board knows this based on what we've provided, but I'm going to say it anyway. She was never talked to, disciplined, in any way chided for her interactions with AL by the university. Not once. And in fact, when she asked about what was going on with AL, in the terms of, you know, what was going on with him at the school and the trouble that he was in, she was told, well, he's complained about everything except you. He's complained about everything at this university except you. So the school was never critical, never had a problem with Dr. Ambrosia and the way that she handled AL. She was meeting with two supervisory psychologists at the time, and she was talking about the issues with AL with those two supervisors all the time, one of them being the department chair, Tom Wooldridge. This was a big problem. AL's conduct in the class was a problem. And Dr. Ambrosia, as a new professor, did her best to try to welcome him in, make him feel less defensive. She'll address more of that, so I'm not going to say too much about that. I don't want to use up her time. None of his complaints came up, and none of his realizations as to the damage he had suffered came up until after he was suspended. That's when he said he realized how he had been damaged by her. He makes some causal link between the two by claiming that because she had somehow been jilted by him, she filed complaints and was seeking retribution. That is inaccurate. Dr. Ambrosia never filed a complaint, never complained about him, never expressed a concern to the university about him, other than in the talks where she was trying to get supervision as to how to handle the class. She was never a witness against him in any way. She wasn't involved in any of the proceedings that had anything to do with his severance from the university. Those were separate issues. He was severed because of his behavior in another class and complaints filed by students, not by Dr. Ambrosia. So I just wanted to clarify those few things. I think that there was a need to maybe address a few of those points, but I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Ambrosia at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Ambrosia, please be sure to state your name for the record, and then you may proceed with your statement.
My name is Elisa Ambrosia.
Thank you.
Good morning, members of the board. And I'd like to thank you for having this hearing and for allowing me.
Dr. Ambrosia, you're going to need to get a little closer to your microphone. I'm having trouble hearing you, and I'm sure the board is.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. So, good morning, members of the board. I'd like to thank you for having this hearing and for allowing me time to speak. In the 2020, I entered into academia at a time when the whole world got turned on its heel. And I found myself in some very difficult situation that in retrospect, I was unprepared for and I didn't have much control over.
Dr. Ambrosia, I'm sorry to stop you, but you're going to have to speak up. Everyone's really struggling to hear you.
Really?
Yes.
Let me see if I maybe plug.
Yeah, that might work.
She's breaking up, it sounds like to me, Artie.
Yeah.
I think what's going on, Jean, is that when she's far from the microphone, it's not picking up everything, and so it sounds like it's cutting out.
How is this?
Go ahead and speak some more.
Okay. Can you hear me better?
Yes, I think.
I can try to move the mic closer. Let me know if it's still, maybe I can phone in if it's still problematic.
Yeah, if you would like to continue, we can, yeah, we'll stop you if it's still a problem. Thank you.
Sure. Should I restart or is it okay? Do I see it?
You can go ahead and restart.
Restart? Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, members of the board. I'd like to thank you for having this hearing and for allowing time to speak. In 2020, I entered into academia at a time when the whole world got turned on its heel. And I found myself in some very difficult situations that in retrospect, I was unprepared for and didn't have much control over. I started teaching at the beginning of the pandemic when all classes went online, coinciding with a drastic increase in enrollment. I went from someone being assigned a class of 10 to 15 students to being a new professor teaching multiple different classes with an overwhelming number of students in each. Because of COVID, there were fewer academic and administrative resources available to me. The situation was one where everyone was drenched. It was a very difficult time, to say the very least. It was also a time of great social upheaval, revolving around perceived injustice by law enforcement against certain minority groups. I'm sure everyone remembers that. Against this backdrop, I was also asked to teach classes that focused heavily, and one class exclusively, on discussion about multicultural issues, particularly race, gender, and sexuality. Over time, I found myself increasingly dealing with a student who was experiencing this difficult issue personally and in relation to his experience at GGU. This person made it clear that in his communication with me that he felt othered, divided, unwanted, not liked by others. He suspected that fellow students and the administrators were racist. My intent with the student was good. I was hoping to remove obstacles that were causing him learning and situations, difficulties in the environment that we were in.
Dr. Ambrosia, I'm sorry, Dr. Davis-Wilson, I'm not trying to interrupt the meeting, but I think we're starting to struggle to hear you. You're pulling the microphone away, and what's happening is you're speaking at a pretty good volume when you start a sentence, but you're trailing off sort of like this at the end of it. No one can hear you. So you just need to kind of keep your voice at a steady level and speak where everyone can hear you, okay?
The other thing I would encourage, just look at the screen. You're turning your face to look at us and then back at the screen.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Sorry if I won't look at you then for a few minutes. Okay, so my intent with the student was good. I was hoping to remove obstacles that were causing him difficulty learning and his situation in this environment. I also did that for other students in many different ways. But this person I felt needed additional attention. Oh, and I felt that the best thing I could do for this student was to help him feel heard and make him feel welcome. I genuinely felt that it could offer important viewpoints to the class. If you look at all the texts, there were hundreds related to cultural issues, books, art, conferences, documentary, music, and even language. For example, you notice that I emailed a picture of a black man and a white woman. This was a cultural reference that Ayal had raised of a drawing inspired by Basquiat, an artist he had discussed, and by sending him this email, I was simply affirming that I was interested in the discussion. I was hoping to help him connect to other students and faculty and to feel safe rather than threatened, which would perhaps reduce his defensiveness or accusatory attitudes towards his fellow students and the administration. And I had hoped to inspire confidence and trust in him. In retrospect, unfortunately, I was not able to establish the desired rapport. Throughout the course of our interaction, constantly accused me of harboring racist attitudes at the subconscious level. And so, as I reflect on the situation and look at all the emails and texts, I can see how the board might think that the number of texts is surprising within the context of a teacher-student relationship. And as I reviewed the text in preparation for this matter, I too was surprised by the number of texts. In each individual interaction, I was responding to the particular context. So for example, when I contacted him, often it was because there was a particularly difficult discussion in class that day that did not go so well. I would like to correct a statement in the investigative report that said that I did six provision concerns. I want the board to know that I did seek supervision. The supervision that was available to me during these unprecedented times, there were available supervisors with Tom Woodbridge and Dr. Jeffrey Leiter. I spoke with them about AL and the difficulty I was having with and the university. I never shared any confidential information about the with supervisor or anyone else. In closing, I know that AL presented a story of how I harmed him and his academic leader at GQ. But I assure you that I have nothing to do with anything that happened to him at the university outside of my classes. I had nothing to do with those administrative processes. I was not working behind the scenes to sabotage him. Whatever happened to him is completely unrelated to the discussion that was taking place in the attacks on Kong. In summary, I would like this board to consider that I came from a good place. I was trying to help someone who was struggling. If I could do this all over again, I think I would have ended my effort to establish rapport with him much sooner, and I would have put greater pressure on the administration to take action. In my defense, I did consult with the department chair on an ongoing basis, and I was never presented with an alternative to the approach I had chosen. And now I'm happy to turn it back to the board and answer any questions the board might have. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for being patient with us as we work through the volume issues. And thank you, Mr. Eaves, for supporting through that as well. Board members, do you have any questions for Dr. Ambrosia?
Yeah, I do. Dr. Ambrosia, thank you so much for being here. I know teaching during COVID times was extremely challenging as an academic administrator. That was something that we spent a lot of time with our faculty as they were starting to teach in new venues, and also encouraging our faculty to have close communications with the students. So I'm well aware of being on the other side, you know, encouraging faculty to do that. So, my first question is, when I look at what we have in terms of all the text messages and calls, most of them was between a certain time period. So when you taught the first class, were you texting AL?
No.
Okay, the second, now you taught two classes or three?
The first term I taught three classes and AL was in one class.
Okay.
And the second term I taught three classes and AL was in two classes.
Okay, so that's where the three come from. Okay, that's, I knew there were three classes, but I'm trying to, okay. So the first class, I don't see any. So it seems like most of the records we have in terms of phones and texts started in December. I'm scrolling, I'm sorry.
20.
Yeah, December 20 and goes through March, you know. And I know how easy it is to go back and forth with texts. You know, it's like those one-word responses, so there might be four or five texts. Some of them are pretty late, you know. And a lot of them were casual conversations. Were you having similar conversations with other students in the class?
Yes.
Okay, so students would ask you questions and you would respond and you would go back and forth. Okay. Was there a difference in the relationship that you had with AL as opposed to the other students in the class?
I wouldn't say there was a difference in the relationship. You know, I tried to address each student's needs and relate to those needs the best I could with the resources I had. So I treated everyone the same, and I tried to take the lead and kind of, you know, for instance, we had students who were in the military and they were very formal. I would reciprocate. So I wouldn't say I treated them.
Okay. So you also mentioned
Can I address one issue?
Yeah.
You were asking about timing. And I think it's of note that the texts really seemed to start to ramp up. It coincided exactly with the time that the Chauvin trial started. That's the officer that was convicted of murdering George Floyd. And so the texts really started to ramp up at that time, if you really analyze
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted to kind of point that out because I saw that you were interested in the timing.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Eaves. So you mentioned that you sought supervision from two of your department chairs, other faculty. Did you bring up the conversation of the text, or were you just focusing on the relationship, you know, the number of texts back and forth?
I did both. For instance, with Dr. Leiter, I at some point even asked him about cactus flower because there's some, you know, cultural differences between the United States and Europe. And he provided me feedback about that. And
what was the feedback? Can you talk about it?
Sure. His feedback, he said that it has to be a two-way street, that you can't just extrapolate in the need of the other person, especially if that person is in the United States, so that you have to abide to, you know, cultural norm of where the person is, and of course, be respectful of their own cultural background. So he seemed to suggest that it was important to take the whole global situation in view. And also, you know, I constantly spoke with him about the difficulties I was having at GGU, and he was really wonderful in letting me grow in terms of really appreciating the kind of resources that I should have had available to me. You know, it really helped me. I've never taught, so it never even occurred to me that, you know, those things aren't there. It really helped me see this. And recently when I was contacted by the board, by department saying, Dr. Ambrosia, can you please share, you know, your PowerPoint for the psychological assessment and any tips you may have with this incoming professor that is going to teach you the fall? He, Dr. Leiter, later really spent a lot of time saying, you know, those are your own psychological, intellectual property. You shouldn't just give it out for free, and your time is valuable. And so, you know, really helped me be sort of mentoring things that you learn along the way.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Ambrosia. I'll pause for right now.
Thank you. Additional questions from board members? Dr. Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Ambrosia, for being here. A couple of questions. One is similar to what Dr. Malott asked, is was your text volume with AL similar or to other students or more?
I would say I had more text volume with AL. You know, I follow the beat of the student. And unfortunately, because of the way of being remote, text became a means of relating. I would never have used this. You know, I don't use it in my private practice or anything like that, but it seems that it's what is available in the world today, especially if you are remote.
Dr. Ambrosia, I'm having a little trouble hearing you, so I'm sure that means the rest of the board members are. So I missed some of that response, but Dr. Meyer, I'd also point out that the problem that she had to address with AL was an ongoing problem. His conduct in the classroom was one that persisted throughout his tenure at that university. So issues that she had to deal with for other students, like the student who told her that they were homeless and couldn't get on the Zoom class, or other issues like that, were I think more easily solved. So I think the volume of the text messages reflects the duration of the problem as well, and the fact that it's,
well, what was the problem? Because I don't see
the problem.
In the texts any corrective feedback, any addressing the terms of endearment being used. I don't see any kind of teaching or guiding aspects. So what problem is she addressing?
I think that's a good question, and I'm glad you asked, because it's a matter of perspectives here. The problem is that he was so unruly in class that students were leaving, dropping, complaining to Dr. Ambrosia every day. It was creating a real miserable situation for the people who were in that class. And from Dr. Ambrosia's perspective, she can address this herself, but I know this is what was going on. From her perspective, AL was feeling defensive. He was feeling that his opinions were not welcome. He was feeling that, you know, there were racists in the class. He said that quite often. I mean, he was constantly accusing not only Dr. Ambrosia, but all of the students in the class the university itself, the dean of the university, of being racist. And so I think what you're seeing reflected in those texts, you're right. She doesn't say to him, you need to behave yourself in class, and you need to stop confronting people, and you need to stop cross-examining students every day until they admit that they're racists. She's not saying those things. What she's trying to do is engage him in discussions about his cultural views for the most part. There are hundreds of texts sent back and forth about art, poetry, conferences, videos on YouTube, documentaries. If you look at what she's doing is she's saying, I value your opinions. I value your insights. She's welcoming him to a discussion. And so you're right. She doesn't correct him outright, but I think what she's trying to do is eliminate his defensiveness. So I didn't mean to steal her thunder.
Okay, so Dr. Ambrosia, could you answer the question? What were these texts professional? Did you maintain a professional boundary with you and your student?
I believe I did. I was friendly in a way that was culturally appropriate. To my mind, it would have been very distancing and insulting to be rigid. You know, he told me I spoke the high English, implying that as a white person, I am catering to the parents. So I try to accommodate his cultural perspectives to the best way that I could. And I provided him with information about culture and, as Eves was saying, you know, art, poetry, lectures, books, references, as a way of gaining his trust and make him feel valued. And his opinions were valued and important.
Okay, so you maintain that you kept a professional boundary throughout all of your interactions with him.
Yeah. I mean, okay. I certainly, you know, can see that the number of texts can look, in retrospect, as I said, you know, it took me reading all the texts, preparing for this board, to say, oh my gosh, there are a lot of texts here. And what I can tell you is that in the moment, I was just responding to the issue at hand. I wasn't thinking, oh, there are 7 texts and 8 of these, you know. So I should have, you know, take a step back and look at that. But I was doing the best I could, given the circumstances I was in.
Okay, and beyond just the number of texts, it's the content, though. Do you believe that the content was appropriate, or the when he's referring to you as a cactus flower, and there's no response to that, how could that be interpreted by him when he's giving you a nickname and you roll with it and don't correct that?
I agree. As I said, I was relating to him under his cultural training and my own to some extent. As I said in my response, you know, Italians are a little bit different in the way that they relate. However, you know, it took me to be in supervision with Dr. Lagter to understand the sort of two-way relationship. I thought that I was just meeting his own cultural position. No different to my mind that if someone comes and speaks Italian, I would respond that way, you know. I try to match their presence. And maybe this, you know, with all the CV I did, I learned a lot. And again, I think it takes a lot of time to strike that balance between, I don't know how to put it, but, you know, learning how to interact in the school setting, because it's a different situation, particularly online.
Okay. And what about the late night phone calls?
Sure. I'm glad that you're asking me that. And I can see that just seeing it like that doesn't make any sense. I too see it like, what is this, right? But the classes often ended late. I had only certain available time frames for office hours and for talking to students. Often students would remain on Zoom past the class and, you know, long past the class that was office hours, so to speak. And then the only time that I had available were the times in which we were connected. I, you know, didn't necessarily have other options of time that were available for me. And also the classes were quite late themselves.
And did you have frequent phone calls with other students?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Those are all my questions. Thank you.
Dr. Katarina.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, some of these phone calls were 11, 12 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And is that when you called other students too, at midnight?
Yeah, at times. You know, the class would end late, like 9:30, let's say, and then they would stay on another half hour. Then I would take a break, and then I would get Dr. Ambrosio, can I talk to you? Or, you know, want to check in? And also, I think because of the pandemic, you know, the sense of time that kind of shifted, that was my impression. It's not like you're waking up, going out, you know, the days seem to merge into one another. And so I gave everything I could to the school and students, you know, the time I had available. In retrospect, I can see that. If I had to do it all over again, I would ask for earlier classes and more support and other resources.
I see, you know, sometimes you responded to AL's calls, but there were many where you would look like you texted randomly, are you free now? Can we talk now? And was that just in response to a request from him, or was that just you needing to talk to someone?
They were different, you know, I can't generalize because I don't know exactly mm-hmm. what you're referring to. What I can say is that sometimes I would, after the cultural class, you know, where there was sort of fireworks happening, I would try to reach out to make sure everything was okay. And at other times we would exchange information, either via email, Dr. Ambrosio, can you get me this article? You know, and then I would follow up and check in with him. And also, sometimes other students who were in the queue on Zoom at the end of class would say, you know, Alvin left, but I apologize. AL left. Could you call? And so then I would check in and say, are you okay? And
then the situations about AL's dog and nephew, that seemed very personal.
Yeah, his dog actually was on Zoom during class often. And we would hear him.
Did you know personal things like about their family members for other students or their pets or their nephew, nieces?
Yeah, they... Because, see, I don't know how to describe it. This sort of Zoom situation really opened up the world to students' life in very different ways, and to some extent, patients. You know, you see them in their homes or whatever. And students had their pets. They would have little ones. You know, there was a student who had a child popping in and out. And they were talking about the child because, you know, child care might have been missing. There were going on a bicycle, exercising while in class. They were doing all sorts of different things. So it wasn't a traditional classroom situation.
And how many students did you have in each class approximately?
Around 30, the average.
Now, in the T group, yeah. Was it explained to the students in advance that there would be a supervisor and you would be reporting information to gain supervision to the supervisor?
Yes, and there was a, I want to clarify that too, about supervision, you know, the way the supervision went was that I would describe the generalities of the dynamics of the group. I wouldn't say, you know, AL is doing this and this person is doing that. It's more like the group seems to be split along racial lines. You know, there is one side against the other. What can I do to help them become unstuck? So then Dr. Woolridge would offer some feedback and I would try to implement it. And then more importantly, it was for the benefit of me, having my own blind spots and potential things that I maybe couldn't see. And so, you know, it really focused on me as well, like my own perception.
What prompted you to teach that?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I think the syllabus itself for that course said that there would be issues with, you know, confidentiality of the information that was discussed because of the supervision situation. Okay. So not only was it discussed, but it was in the syllabus. And And she said one thing that could be a little confusing. There was actually a formal arrangement for supervision of the multicultural seminar style class. And I think when she's saying she spoke in generalities about the dynamic of that class to Dr. Woolridge, that's separate from the individual mentoring and training that she's getting as a young professor from the department chair.
Okay. Just one last question, Dr. Ambrosio. So what prompted you to teach the T group class?
Well, sure. Cultural issues are really close to my heart. I started my career working. Working with very disadvantaged populations. And I feel that this is an area that is often underlooked and underappreciated, and it is close to my heart at the topic. So I feel that it's really important to keep this consideration and learn about other cultural perspectives, you know, including me. I never stopped learning. And so I felt and even more generally, my desire to teach was related to wanting to give back to the community. I certainly, I'm sure you know that these kind of jobs don't pay a lot.
And yeah, I had a job, yes.
And so, you know, it was like, I was taught you have to do service and give back. And I thought that this was a way to do it. But certainly you do need the preparation and mentoring and resources that you need to perform properly.
Well, just because AL said that you had not had training in running T groups, and that was my concern.
Okay.
Okay, that's all I have to ask right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Shreve, did you have any questions to ask? You are on mute.
No, she answered it. I wanted to know what time the class ended. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions for Dr. Ambrosio? Hearing none, we will now move into deliberations. Dr. Malott?
Thank you, Dr. Davis-Wilson. You know, this is a kind of a very different type of case. And I do want to start with those statements. And you know, both Dr. Katarina and Dr. Meyer have also been in that position. Dr. Myers is a full-time faculty, as well as Dr. Katarina has been a full-time faculty member at different points in her career. So, Dr. Ambrosia is teaching as an adjunct, which is part-time faculty, which means that is she also has another full-time job. She also started teaching during the pandemic. And, you know, as I read through all of the contents of her text, it did read, there was some class references, but it did read like text between two friends, you know. Was much of the content inappropriate? I did not see it. Between two friends, no. It's, you know, there were casual conversations. Do faculty, are they friendly with their students? And many of us are. And that is not quite prohibited by universities. There is that boundary that we have to maintain. But I would say that many of us get to know our students. We know a lot about them. And depending, and it doesn't occur with every single student, especially in person environments. You get to know your students, you get to know your GAs, you know a lot about them, you support them. And in fact, as an administrator, we encourage that supportive mentoring type relationship between faculty and student. We think it helps with retention. Sometimes that's about the only support students get, but there always needs to be that boundary between faculty and students. You are in a different relationship. You are giving them grades, so that puts you in a power position. And that is sometimes what we look at, that power differential. You know, does a student who's friendlier with the professor get a better grade than the other? That's where I know I get involved as an administrator. And that's not the case here, you know. Yet there was a friendly relationship between the student and the professor and the number of texts. I don't think I've ever texted anybody, but then I didn't teach in an era of texts. And texts can go back and forth. You know, there's a rapid fire of texts. But there were a lot of texts and, you know, a lot of sharing of, you know, good readings, poems, you name it. The student was also having some other issues that the university was addressing, and the result wasn't favorable to the student. Dr. Ambrosia was consulting with the chair, and consulting with the chair and sharing that information often happens. The confidentiality, this is not a client-patient confidentiality. And so we have to really separate the two out. We cannot bring the two in. I want to know everything that happens in a class when there's a problem brought to me as an administrator. So I can really help understand. I can find out if the boundaries were crossed and I can help with the situation and counsel the students. So we have to be really careful as we deliberate that we think about this as faculty-student relationship. Yes, the psychologist is a psychologist, but they are not in a psychological. And Ms. Shreve, you asked that question, which is a very important question, you know. So we have to be careful in our own deliberations, you know, and when you read the standards, yes, they talk about dual relationships and, but the dual relationships, you know, there are certain boundaries and sometimes I wonder, is this a case, if something like this happened at my university, I would want to see it as an administrator. I would not take it to the psych board. So, you know, so I'm struggling with that issue. You know, so where does it cross? I know we talked about in the complaint screening committee, this came up and we said, is this the purview of our board? You know, and then we looked at the ethics and it does talk about dual relationships. And so was there a dual relationship and to what extent? And yet we have dual relationships to some extent at universities where faculty, especially graduate students, I was part of an accreditation review. I was a student and our faculty got dinged because they were not having enough friendly relations. You know, they were not doing enough social events with the students. And this was a site visit and they said, you know, you need to socialize your students into the profession and have more social. How are you preparing your students to be professional? So it's a very gray area. And so that's what we are dealing with. Yet, I want to acknowledge the number of texts. And even Dr. Ambrosia, yeah, when she was going back and looking at it, that was a lot of texts. And a lot of just chatter, you know, not just related to academic stuff. So that's kind of, I just want to kind of share my thoughts as I kind of wrestle with this whole thing and kind of go back and forth between a psychologist hat, an administrative hat, and a faculty hat. And I have all three hats in here. And but I'm really interested in hearing from my colleagues. So
thank you, Dr. Mollett. Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thank you for your comments, Dr. Mollett. I also struggled a lot with this on, was Dr. Ambrosia practicing under her license, right? We can have faculty who have training in psychology that are teaching psychology classes, and it has nothing to do with the professional license. And we even have people that are teaching prevention and intervention courses that aren't licensed, and they're not practicing, they're not seeing clients, but they're teaching the material because they were involved in it from a research perspective. One of the classes I believe was on psychotherapy, and there was a psychodynamic course. So again, that blurs the lines. If was this professional practice as opposed to something that a non-licensed person would also be doing? And so that's the first part. The second part is I can see both sides of it. I can see AL's concerns that reading those texts and looking at the interactions and the late phone calls, I can see how he would have interpreted this as a relationship more than just a professional teacher-student relationship. And I can see Dr. Ambrosia's point on she was doing her best in a crazy time to try to help a student. I mean, I took a CEUs on white professors addressing racism in class because it was a nonstop topic and I didn't know how to do this without offending, without making a mistake. And I made mistakes, and I think lots of people did. I think people were trying their best and learning from this and continuing to learn. So I get it. I mean, I had to tell people you got to wear clothes when you're coming on Zoom. The student, it was, don't let people walk behind you when, I mean, it was there. You could not completely maintain professional boundaries in some cases, right? So we were all trying to figure it out. So I do see AL's point. I do see Dr. Ambrosia's point. I don't see a violation here. I do see the need for ongoing education and consultation, but I think we could say that to most people teaching and dealing with these transitions.
Tree.
I would agree with Dr. Myers. I often think back at what Dr. Gohansky used to say, who's the client? And he'd always go, who's the client? And in this situation, I mean, was she working under her license? No, she's been an adjunct. And if you look at, I mean, if there was a complaint to be had, I think it would be more with the university regarding her teaching and maybe interaction. But I don't see where it falls under our rules or statutes where a violation was made in regards to her license. Were there mistakes as an adjunct? I guess we could all discuss the pros and cons to them, the emails or whatnot. But as far as the statutes and the rules, I don't see where a violation has taken place.
Would the board care to receive legal advice in executive session?
I would ask to receive legal advice in executive session.
And I'll second. We got a motion and a second. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries.
Hi, Diana?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Dr. Simmons, and I just wanted to check.
I had a training plan modification that had been on the board's agenda a few times before and kept getting pushed back for not having a quorum. And I was told it was going to be addressed today. And I've been on for 2 hours now.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Simmons. It is on the agenda today. What you'll notice on the agenda is that we do have timed items that, and then non-timed items. And so the non-timed items are introduced during times when we have breaks between the timed items or during other things. So the timed items do take precedence, but we are aware that you are here and we do want your item to be seen today as well for the same reasons that you mentioned. And so we will work diligently to get to them. So we appreciate your patience.
Okay. I mean, I know initially I was told that like my sort of concern was typically handled within the first 5-10 minutes of the meetings, which was the case the last time I was on. They were brought up and it was like, we don't have a quorum. So moving on. Yes. I don't know if I can stay on a 4-hour meeting. I'll do my best.
Yeah, thank you. The other meetings are a different type of meeting, and then it comes through on the consent agenda after that because of the lack of quorum. It does look a little bit different, but I will take your consideration into note, and we can work after this. We'll have a short comfort break, and then I can work to with board staff at a potential solution for you.
Okay.
You text Dr. Simmons when we are maybe board staff could, so he doesn't have to.
Actually, that is a really great suggestion. Thank you, Dr. Malott, for reminding me. If you would like to step off and would like a text message of when we are going to see the case, or would like an email so that we can reach out to you, that's okay too. We can when we get to that point, we can message you and let you know that it's either upcoming or it can be seen. But if that would be an alternative, that would work.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that works for me. I can give you my phone number. There's no way to...
Maybe you can
just email it to board staff and they will be able to, they'll be able to work that out with you.
So just email my phone number to Kathy, folks.
Would that work? Heidi?
On is Kathy in today? Yes, that would be perfect.
Okay, I will do that. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we've returned from executive session and have, and we'll continue deliberations. Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think what I needed to clarify about my statement was in talking about, does this fall under board jurisdiction? The majority of the state statutes are focused on professional practice as it relates to psychotherapy, right? And so it talks about clients or patients. But we also have adopted the APA ethical code, which also addresses teaching, right? So I think we do have to, anytime a licensed psychologist a complaint is filed, I think we do have to look at that, whether it's psychotherapy or teaching or research. If they're licensed, they do fall under our jurisdiction for that. But the standards are different, right? Like the you can have a problematic dual relationship with a student just as you can with a client, but those may look different, right? So it's the different standards of practice for that field or for that position or activity. So I think that as I said previously, I can see how AL could misinterpret Dr. Ambrosia's interactions, and I can see how Dr. Ambrosia was trying to do her best to meet the needs of a student that was, as we've heard, having difficulties in other courses and with the school. So when dual relationships are allowed, it's when a dual relationship could negatively impact the other person. I don't see this as a it's questionable on is there a dual relationship, but I don't see that it's a violation for a harmful dual relationship.
I want to add a point, and this is more for a general point, Dr. Ma, all of, you know, members of the board. You know, I was just thinking back, I'm thinking, you know, as a faculty member, as a university person, you know, I'm very guilty of sending late night emails, you know. And in fact, I've heard from my faculty that students are expecting emails back between 11 and 2 because they work till 2 o'clock, supposedly. So especially our undergraduate populations, not some, I don't know, but I do late night emails, but emails feel a little less personal, you know. To me, I'm just getting things off my desk. You know, I want to get things done. I'm working late and I'm getting them all out. So it's not unusual for me to wake up in the morning and see a bunch of emails from my students, from other colleagues. Texts seem more personal, you know, and I would really caution anyone in the profession, faculty, psychologists, to be very judicious in the use of texts and email texts and phone calls, you know, late night. It just does not ring, you know. I know the pandemic does not, I don't know, just, you know, that's why we're here today. So,
Dr. Meyer.
And in response to that, I agree, but I have a lot of gray. And I think that younger people don't see the same boundaries between email and text. And
so okay. So I'm sure my age is saying, Dr.
Meyer. That's why I led with grays. So I think you're younger than me. So I didn't want to go there. But I was emailing at 2 and 3, and sometimes they were back and forth live communication through email. I see a difference between calling and texting, but I don't think everybody does. And I did see throughout there. There was frequently a text saying, is it okay to call? And so there did seem to be some level of boundaries demonstrated by Dr. Ambrosio.
And Dr. Malott and Dr. Meyer, I just wanted to add, I do agree. And I am also a full-time faculty with the university. No, you're good. I have been faculty for many years, and I have taught at many universities as adjunct. And I would agree with all of that. And, you know, some of the things I had learned early on, even about the late night emails, about scheduling my emails to go out, because the only dean concerns that I've been involved in have been students expecting an email response and them not getting it 3 o'clock in the morning, and that's their, you know, time. And so I had adopted early on kind of a policy of Microsoft is amazing, where you can actually schedule out your emails. So I may be working at night, but I do try to still set that boundary, because I think, to Dr. Meyer's point, I do think the email has become almost as casual as text messaging, and that there isn't really a difference between the two, especially in the world of social media today, because I think that seems to be a way that people, you know, instant messaging is also, you know, this popular means of accessing people. I think for me, the boundary comes to connecting it back to the university versus personal. And there are ways to set up, you know, numbers that are just specific to the work at the university, and making sure that when you are meeting with students rather than a phone call, you know, most universities have access to Zoom or WebEx or other ways to exchange numbers in such a way that there are some boundaries. I know I had asked, and this is something too, as far as, you know, trying to weigh like what, you know, kind of falls in this board, and I do agree with the conclusion that the ethics code does address this, and therefore by having the ethics code adopted, this does, you know, fall here. And I think that's ultimately what moved this from CSC to this point. I also have some empathy for not just the time. I think the time matters. It was uncharted water. It's still in a lot of ways uncharted water because we're dealing with the effects of the pandemic still. You know, there were students that went from in-person to online that are struggling to get back into the classroom. We're still seeing many of these effects. And so I do understand that as well. But I also have some empathy for some of, and I don't want to speak negatively about all universities or anything, but having been adjunct for several universities, it is kind of like a, hey, you're kind of qualified. Could you do this with us? And if you had not had any prior experience, either with a university that has very, very extensive rules and policies and orientations and these sorts of things, I've been in situations where it's just like, here, and someday this semester, make sure you take our orientation so we can, you know, cross that off the list. And then as I've gone to other universities, we're talking, you know, how small, you know, even Title IX discrimination can look and all of these different things that I was like, wow, I wish I would have known this in these contexts and these other circumstances. So I do have a little bit of empathy that it isn't just these times. I think when we talk standards of care as just a university professor, there is a lot of gray. And I think some of that gray falls into the administration and their policies around these things, because I think it can differ between what my administration at my university has in place versus what like Dr. Malott has in place. And so there is a lot of kind of gray area there. I think the one thing that whether or not it changes an analysis for anybody, I think the one thing that stands out to me, and perhaps again, it's because I am through COVID becoming myself through the last 3 years becoming myself self-aware of my own positions of you know, privilege and power. I do think that it's very important that regardless of that role, we recognize how these roles can be perceived as power or be powerful, right? Because it is a grade. And I think Dr. Malott hit on that. And so I do think that's where it for me can kind of cross over, is that unlike other lines of work, perhaps there isn't an understanding at a level of, you know, psychology means an understanding of how that impact, like if I were teaching in an engineering class, I don't know that impact necessarily would be something I could relate. Whereas as a psychologist, someone who has had that training, somebody who is licensed and practicing in other realms, I would expect that that some of those boundaries could be more clear, understanding how quickly some of these other, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know all of the right terms, I'm a behavior analyst, but like, you know, we talk about inference and all these other things, how quickly that can happen. In some settings, an instructor may not even know those things, but I would expect that somebody who is licensed in this jurisdiction or another jurisdiction would safeguard even in their role as a teacher against some of those things. So I just, like I said, I'm speaking more like from how I do it as an instructor myself, knowing how quickly that slippery slope can happen. But that would be, you know, the only thing I would add to that. Dr. Caterino, did you have?
Well, I just thought I wanted to review what are our levels. There's a letter of concern, or what are the different levels of like just missing?
I think if you're asking for legal advice, we might.
Yeah. Oh, I should have done it before. So, okay. Never
I think
mind.
You're asking just in general.
Yes.
There's a non-disciplinary order for continuing education. There's a letter of concern. Those are non-disciplinary. And then you get into the disciplinary realm with censure, probation, suspension or revocation. I think that I didn't miss
that's,
anything, did
that's
I?
That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm ready to make a motion. I'd like to move to dismiss. I think we've kind of expressed our concerns. We've talked about the gray area, but I still don't feel that this rises to a statutory violation. So I would like to go ahead and dismiss.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
I was thinking of letter of canary letter of concern.
Okay. So we have a motion and a second. I would just again reiterate the importance, not just for you, Dr. Ambrosia, but for anybody else who may be on this call or who may listen to this, the importance of really understanding your role when you do take on a teaching position, working with administration and resolving conflict with administration ahead of time. So if you know that administration policies may be of conflict to an ethics code or statutory regulations, working with that administration, it could be as simple as the way things are being described differ. And so it's not even a conflict, but when you get to the bottom of it, it's like, oh, okay, we're both on the same page. I also would encourage anybody looking to get into the realm of teaching to take CEs in the area. And again, this is, again, looking at scope of practice and what our ethical requirements are, because it isn't, it isn't the same. The standard of practice for teaching isn't the same. And I think that it's very important that in order to protect the students, protect the public, and even to protect, you know, yourself, to make sure that we recognize that teaching is kind of a scope of its own practice and that we should be taking CEUs. I like that Dr. Meyer mentioned that, you know, as he was pivoting, he was also quickly trying to take CEUs in that particular area, because I think that sometimes that gets missed. It's like, here you can teach, and then we go to professional conferences and we look at all of the different things that we're doing with clients, and we continue to miss all of these amazing opportunities to get continuing education in higher education. There's a ton of programs. Some of the universities offer free memberships to higher education programs. So if you're not like CE opportunities or newsletters, if you are going to get back into teaching or you are on this call and teaching is important to you, talk to your administration about what access to those types of tools they can give you. And treat it as if you would in your practice as a psychologist, your practice as an instructor. There's incredible national groups out there producing CEs that really can give you great information about being an instructor. So, so I apologize, but so that would just be, again, my general comments is, you know, to anybody seeing this, if you are going to dabble in different types of clients, if you will, for how the ethics code kind of morphs it, to just make sure that you're doing due diligence to continue with the scope of practice. Continuing educations, as Dr. Meyer alluded to, and what he did during that pandemic. So, and many of us did, because it was uncharted. So, all right, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Me.
All right, we have the motion.
And Dr. Davis-Wilson, how did you vote?
Aye.
Aye, okay. Mm-hmm. So 7-1 is what I got.
Thank you. And I would like to, again, thank all parties for being here. This was complex. I hope it was a learning opportunity for everybody. And so thank you for your time. We are going to go ahead, I think, and take
five.
Five. You want a 5-minute comfort break?
I hope we'd be done by noon.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and do a 5-minute comfort break. If you come back quicker, there are some new materials added for the next agenda item. I would, Ms. Pacnon, if we could go ahead and have Dr. Simmons come back. I do want to make sure that we see his today and that we have a quorum. It should go pretty quick, and then we'll move along with the agenda. So we'll be back in 5 minutes.
And Madam Chair and members of the board and members of the audience, this is Ms. Poe. I'm going to go ahead and give out the first CE code word. If this meeting does last 4 hours, it is eligible. The first CE code word is parrot. Parrot. P-A-R-R. OT. Thank you.
Board staff, this is Dr. Davey. I'm going to have to step off this call from 11 to 11:15 to deal with something for my other job that's not related to being a, on the psychology board, which is now a part-time job. So just FYI, that there'll be a 15-minute gap where I have to jump off.
Thank you, Dr. Davey.
And DJ, I see that you may have a question. If you wouldn't mind emailing that to board staff so that they can, during the break, take a look at that, that would be appreciated.
Yes, ma'am.
Dr. Davis-Wilson, I think we just need affirmation that Mr. Nguyen is here. That will give us the quorum.
Okay. Mr. Nguyen, have you returned? So we need 6 for a quorum, right? I think we have a quorum.
Dr. Myers recused.
Oh, that's right.
Right.
Which is why we're here. We'll get there, Dr. Simmons. We're pulling it together. Mr. Nguyen.
He's there.
Excellent.
Yay. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Simmons, for all of your patience. And we will work on this real quick for you. Okay. We have the next agenda item is going to be item number 13. Dr. Katarina, will you please provide us a summary of this application?
Okay. So Dr. Simmons received his temporary license in December of 21. Then in 8:30 of 21, there was the first postdoc plan submitted with Dr. Shelton. There was a new supervisor change in November of 21. And then in January of 22, another new supervisor. May 20, another new supervisor. Then on June 26, 22, Dr. Simmons emailed the board to ask if he needed to contact the board regarding supervisor changes. And then he sent in a new training plan on the 19th. Now, it is important to keep in mind that there's a statute ARS 32-2073B, which indicates that any modification to the training plan should be submitted within 10 days. So my question for Dr. Simmons was, the training plan sent in. I don't see any contact to the board after the in November of 21, January of 22, or May of 22. And then I see more than a 10-day delay between the new supervisor coming in May to when you emailed the board and when you submitted the training plan, more than 10 days. So I'd like to just ask him to explain.
Dr. Simmons?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things with that. I think one was, I'm not sure about the specific language of the changes to the training plan. I believe what I had seen says that if it's that there are certain changes that the board needs to be notified of, and finding what information and what changes actually require notification and training plan modification was not really clear. That's a part of it. The other big part of it is that initially Dr. Shelton was supposed to be back within about a month, month and a half, and was going to return to be my primary supervisor. That kept happening repeatedly for several months after that. So each month it was like expecting that she would be back within a few weeks or a month. And so eventually it turned out that she was not going to return to the employment of ASU at all. And so that's when I was like, okay, well, obviously I need to figure out what I need to do, because I don't even know if I can get, I don't have like direct contact with her anymore. So all of the supervisors that I have had are all licensed psychologists in the state of Arizona for multiple years. And I actually currently have 2 supervisors. So two of the names that are on there is Dr. Gina Froelich and Dr. Kendall Kirshner. Dr. Kirshner is my primary one who basically sort of goes over my notes and signs off on them. I am also still supervised by Gina Froelich, so I am actually very well supervised. And so hopefully that kind of explains how it was kind of complicated. I kept expecting that Dr. Shelton was going to be back, and then that never happened.
But the only question I have is on the paperwork and Amendment 1, it doesn't, like where you put in Dr. Shirley Yang, it doesn't say temporary supervisor. It says new primary supervisor. So it looked like it was a definite change, not a fill-in waiting for Dr. Shelton to come back. And the same thing with the Froelich in January.
Right. And that and those that was somewhat done retroactively when it became clear that they were going to be the primary and not just a temporary or delegated sort of supervisor.
Well, okay, let me think about that. And then you have the 10-day requirement from when you contact the Kirshner you knew was going to be the new supervisor as of May 20th. At that point, you knew that Shelton was coming back. And that, then there was a delay from May 20th to June 26th when you contacted the board, and then to July 19th when you sent in the training plan. Both of those were all more than 10 days.
Yeah, and some of that was trying to collect, the signatures of the different supervisors that I had. And obviously during the summer, you know, this being a university, a lot of people end up taking time off here and there because they're trying to catch up on everything after, you know, being really swamped during the semesters.
But it is for the supervisors, they do have a 12-month, not a 9-month contract, correct?
Well, I'm sorry, what's that?
The supervisor's contract is a year, 12 months, not just 9 months. Like they were available, they should be available in the summer, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yes, they are. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, four different supervisors now on in my training plan.
Okay.
And so getting it out to people and getting the signatures back on the same page was just a logistical thing that took time.
Okay. Well, I have no other questions if anybody does.
Yeah, I think, I think one of the things the board probably needs to do, and maybe we can do it in a substantive policy statement, is what are the changes, you know, in a big organization like Dr. Simmons, where you have multiple supervisors, and, you know, so the key is that they're getting regular 2-hour supervision for every 40 hours, and, you know, and you have multiple qualified individuals. And what are the things that we really need to know? You know, and 10 days, believe me, to get a thing signed is almost impossible in today's world of telecommuting and things like that. So I don't want to penalize Dr. Simmons. 10 days reporting, yeah, you got a DUI, you call in 10 days, you know you got a DUI, you got the charge, you call and you report it. You're not depending on getting signatures from a bunch of different people. Signatures are like challenging. So that 10 days seems almost onerous, you know. So we probably need to discuss that as a board. Maybe it can be an agenda item for another meeting. And what are the things that we really need to have in place? I think the things that, and kind of really make that clear, these changes need to be, you know, modified. So that's just something. But I think at this point, we need to approve Dr. Simmons' revised plan. Is that?
Yes, I did want to know, do we have to have written signatures or electronic signatures? Because they can be gotten much easier.
Oh, believe it or not, I don't know about that. Some people don't respond quickly to emails. So.
But I think, yes, we're up to see if we will accept his new training plan.
I'll make the motion to accept.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Thank you, Dr. Simmons, for your patience while we work through this.
No, thank you very much as well. I appreciate it. And Have a great rest of the meeting and a great long weekend.
Thank you. Same to you.
Take care.
All right. We will now move to agenda item number 2230. Heidi, can you fix a name on there real quick for or Jennifer? Agenda item 9, complaint number 2230 in regards to Dr. Olshan. Ms. Pakanon, can you please provide us an update on this status?
Madam Chair, actually, Ms. Michelson has prepared one.
Yes, I'll provide an update. And I do just want to let the members know that a little bit ago, I did upload an email exchange that occurred between Dr. Olshan and myself during today's meeting for you to review. During the meeting, Dr. Olshan emailed me requesting a continuance for today's initial case review on the basis that he believes that he was not given sufficient time to obtain an attorney. I do want to note that the record for this case indicates otherwise, which I will describe in a little bit more detail. Dr. Olshan was properly noticed of today's meeting, and he was actually present when the meeting initially started at 8:30. At 9:40 a.m. today, Dr. Olshan emailed me indicating that he would be leaving the meeting shortly and is formally requesting a postponement for today's case review as he plans to retain an attorney in the next week. Dr. Olshan also stated in his email that he was not given sufficient time to retain an attorney. I noted that he left the board meeting while the board was reviewing our last case. I did reply to Dr. Olshan indicating that it was suggested that he remain in the meeting and personally make his request to the board for a postponement. He did not rejoin the meeting, but he did respond to my email at 10:34 a.m. indicating that selecting an attorney is not an easy process and that it takes time. And his reason for also leaving the meeting is also predicated on gathering witnesses for his case review. Dr. Olshan stated that he believed he was not given due process, and if the board does not grant his request for a continuance today, he will pursue other legal avenues. He added in another email that was sent at 10:43 a.m. that he never thought he would need an attorney until he received a notice of these violations. I do want to make note that Dr. Olshan was given sufficient notice that he had the right to retain an attorney for this complaint. First off, the complaint notification letter for this case was sent to Dr. Olshan on May 2nd and specifically made mention of this right. Dr. Olshan was present at the CSC case review on July 21st. However, I recall that Dr. Olshan left the meeting during the committee's deliberation when they were discussing potential violations. Later that afternoon on the same date of the CSC meeting, I emailed Dr. Olshan with follow-up questions that the committee had, and I also informed him that the initial case review would take place today. I mailed out the meeting notice to him on July 28th, which detailed all of the violations that are before you today. So Dr. Olshan was notified more than 30 days in advance of this meeting. On August 8th, he emailed me stating that he was in the process of interviewing attorneys. I did not hear back from him. So on August 17th, I inquired if he had retained an attorney as I had not received any letter of representation. He replied that he had not yet and that he'd rather not have to hire an attorney and he should know by the end of this week. However, I did not hear anything further from him until receiving this email during the board meeting. So please let me know if you have any questions. The board may wish to receive legal advice from Ms. Galvin regarding his request for a postponement. Thank you.
Ms. Galvin, shortly before right as we were breaking, I also noted that the complainant had a question and I wanted to make sure, Ms. Pakanon, if you guys were able to resolve that or if there's anything we need to take into consideration from that. Okay, you're good, DJ. Okay, then Ms. Galvin, I'm going to go ahead and make a motion that we go into executive session for legal advice.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. All right. I do think we have everybody back. The issue before us at this moment is to review a request for an extension made by Dr. Olshan. I am the lead on this case, so I'll go ahead and begin deliberations. I am concerned with the timeline in which this request has come forward. I think that ample notice was provided. We have ample documentation before us to show that that perhaps the need for the extension and the basis of the request is not accurate. And I would move to go ahead and deny the request for an extension or for a postponement or whatever.
Seconded.
You have a motion and a second. Any further questions or comments, discussion?
Could you say it again? Because I was cut out. Could you repeat the motion, please?
Yes. So the motion is to deny the request for a continuance.
Okay.
We have a second. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Dr. Millett, thank you. Any opposed?
No.
Right. We have, I believe, six yes, one no. The motion carries. All right. We will now proceed with an overview of the case. I am the lead on this, so I will provide that overview. All right, on April 29th, 2022, board staff received a complaint from DJ via his current wife against Dr. Olshan, alleging that Dr. Olshan provided services to his son without the father's written consent or knowledge, failed to interview father as part of the evaluation process, made a recommendation regarding custody based on one-sided information from mother, and did not interview all relevant parties in the matter. To include father. On the same day as the complaint, the court issued an order regarding DJ and his ex-wife, who have one son together, to modify legal decision-making, parenting time, and child support. It is noted from the complaint that it appears that mother submitted a motion to modify the terms after having received Dr. Olshan's report. With this complaint, father supplied Dr. Olshan's report and various information from DCS to include a 2021 family functioning assessment and an aftercare plan and various notes from the investigation of a child abuse. In October of 2021, mother initiated services with Dr. Olshan. Son was 11 years old at the time. Son had six sessions with Dr. Olshan between October 2021 and April 2022, some of which were with mother present. On February 24th, 2022, Dr. Olshan issued a three-page report at the request of mother regarding son's psychological evaluation, in which he indicated that it was his professional opinion that based on the six sessions with son, the custody arrangements needed to be modified, and that the son should be living with mother at least three-fourths of the time, and that father should have supervised visitation in a structured environment. On June 6, 2022, board staff received Dr. Olshan's two-page complaint response in a timely matter, and it was as follows. Dr. Olshan has a concern regarding the validity of the complaint as it was filed by the father's wife. He feels compelled to share that he has concerns regarding his safety given the circumstances surrounding father's termination from his employment with the police department. Makes Dr. Olshan very uncomfortable knowing that father did not appeal any of the charges that had been placed against him during his termination. It is Dr. Olshan's hope that the board will see the complaint for what it truly is, to be an angry, vindictive individual lashing out after the court ruled that son could live with mother during the week and could attend the school near mother's residence. Dr. Olshan believes that the clinical record will answer any questions that the board may have regarding his recommendations for the son. The complaint presents a much different picture regarding father's relationship with the son. Prior to meeting with the son, mother presented Dr. Olshan an amended parenting plan, which specifically states it is ordered that the parties shall share joint legal decision-making, with mother having final authority over medical issues, including counseling. Throughout the course of treating the son, Dr. Olshan had been assured by multiple parties that father had been informed of Dr. Olshan's counseling of son. The records demonstrate that Dr. Olshan indicated multiple times that he encouraged individuals to inform the father that he would be willing to talk to him. Dr. Olshan never received any correspondence from the father. Dr. Olshan represents that no psychological evaluation took place, and the report incorrectly states this. And he, during the complaint screening, also noted that he had records of his attempts to contact father and his son since supplied the board with a copy of those phone logs. During the CSC, we did identify several statutory concerns, which are presented to you today in the documentation, and that does conclude the summary of this complaint. We do have with us the complainant, DJ. DJ, now would be a time to introduce yourself for the record using only your initials, please. And please do not use your son's name when you refer to him. You can use initials or say my son and we'll understand. But now is a time for you to introduce yourself and, oh, hold that thought. Almost a time for you to introduce yourself, Dr. Malat.
I just had a question. Since we did deny the continuance, should we inform via email Dr. Olshan that it was no?
That's not necessary.
Okay. Right. Great question, Dr. Malat. Thank you. Right. DJ, now would be a great time for you to unmute your line, introduce yourself. Again, initials only, and please do not state your son's name. You may now provide a brief statement to the board.
Okay, thank you. I'm the father. I'm Daniel Jones. I'm father of RJ. I was going through custody through the court when I first got this letter from Mr. Olshan. And when I got it, I was perplexed, A, who he was and how he came to this conclusion with me having majority of custody. I guess I can go a little bit quickly into the background is that since he was, his mom and I split up when he was like a month old. So since he was little, we had 50-50 custody all the way up until he went to kindergarten, where he then went to kindergarten over where I live in Chandler, and she switched to having custody to about two weekends a month. That continued until this last court case when custody got switched. When I got that letter and I had hired a new attorney, everything about the letter, I wasn't that the damage is done, what's done is done. And what we'd have to do is get a comprehensive evaluation for parent alienation and some other things. And it was going to be out of pocket about $25,000 is what I was estimated. And I didn't have that money. And after getting that letter and all and the request, that's kind of where we were. I had made requests from her and her attorney asking who the counselors are. I provided those emails and I was never given the answer. The original counselor who sent it to Olshan had also wrote a letter that even says in there that he didn't want me to know who the counselors were because he keep his safe place and that he had contacted Mr. Olshan for the purpose of a court recommendation. I mean, that was the sole purpose of hiring him.
DJ, I'm sorry for interrupting you. Can you turn off your video and perhaps any of your incoming video? I recognize that you may not be in a great place of service, but perhaps that will help. You're breaking out a little bit.
Okay, sir. How do I do that? Turn off my video.
It'll be on the bottom left.
There you go. And you did mute yourself, so you'll want to unmute yourself. Perfect. You may continue.
Okay. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. I've had three DCS investigations that were filed from his counselor and from his mom. All three have been unfounded. In fact, I have the letters from the last DCS worker that even said she contacted the counselor and the original counselor, Neil, and told him that it's doing a disservice to have counseling going on and not have me involved since I've already been primarily involved his whole life. And she left that message for him. And I still never heard from him or anything. His statement of that he had made attempts to contact me, if he provided that to you, I guess he called my number, but I'd be curious to know what the duration is of the call, if he just hung up when he got an answering machine, because I've never got a message from him ever. I own my own business, so I get a lot of phone calls, and if I don't recognize a number, a lot of times it goes to voicemail, but I've never gotten a voicemail from him, an email, a letter in the mail, anything of who he was or that he was treating my son or anything like that. The damage that's been done is, I mean, it's irreversible. I even since this happened, and I had to pretty much concede in court because I'm getting this letter. I haven't seen my son since then, because now it's the point where she's like, "Well, I don't even have to bring him." You know, I filed police reports that she's not doing her part in bringing him, but it's gone nowhere, and that's kind of where I'm at right now. I don't know. I mean, if there's a lot of allegations, none of them, they've all been investigated, not all been unfounded. And he keeps bringing up my past work history. I just want to be noted that I had 20 years in with the department. I was on my way out, and I got punished for unprofessional text messages to a friend off duty, not during work. That wasn't a cop as it was, but it had nothing to do with anything that he keeps talking about. I mean, I was a police officer, a sergeant with Phoenix for 20 years. I've been in numerous shootings and different violent situations. But when he says that he's heard stories of me being violent, I mean, I've never had a sustained use of force allegation or anything like that. So I don't, I don't understand any of that stuff. But I just, at this point, just what he did, I don't see how there's any professionalism in it. Being an advocate of what his mom wants to accuse me of, it seems like she just hired someone to parrot what she wants to say to the court, and that's what he did. Sorry, I'm a little nervous, and I think that's all.
Thank you. Thank you for that summary. Board members, do you have any questions for DJ? I have just one, just for clarification of the record. So prior to that court order, can you clarify again your son's living arrangement? What was the custody arrangements at that time?
We had just gone through another one a year prior. So before that, it was primarily, and I was the I forget what they call it, the sole or the primary residential house, and then we switched to 50-50. And that's what it was up until this getting that letter from Mr. Olshan, but it was 50-50. I think they called it a 4-3 split, like 4 days, 3 days, and the next week would be 4-3 in my favor, next week 4-3 in her favor.
Thank you. And to clarify, even when it was 50-50, the arrangements remain that your son could go to school near your house. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then when that letter or when that court order changed, did your son have to change schools?
Yes.
Okay. I have no further questions. Dr. Stewart?
Thank you. DJ, do I understand correctly that Dr. Olshan never contacted you prior to rendering a written report to the court?
Never.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Meyer?
Madam Chair, DJ, thank you for being here. Did you have joint medical decision-making decreed at any point during the time your son was seeing Dr. Olshan?
Yes, we've always had joint decision making. It's always been joint. It just recently on this last one, it switched to joint. But if we don't agree, she could have final say.
And when did that switch occur?
When this, after getting all this last thing, after getting the letter from Mr. Olshan, and that's when those things changed.
Okay. And so you never interacted with Dr. Olsham at the beginning of your son's therapy or assessment?
To this day.
We didn't hear that.
I'm sorry. I've never interacted with him to this day.
Okay. Those are all my questions. Thank you.
Dr. Meyer, if I just may clarify for your question about the dates. So Dr. Olshan authored his report in February 2022. And 1 month later in March, the mother submitted a disclosure statement to the family court regarding her motion, indicating that several documents, including Dr. Olshan's report, may be used. And then on April 29th is when the court issued the order that he is referring to. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Catarino.
That was my question is when he began, Dr. Oh. Olsham began seeing the boy, and then when the mother having the final decision-making began. So that was answered. Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions for DJ? Hearing none. We can now move into deliberation. Since I am the lead on this case, I will begin. I have significant concerns here. I think this is a circumstance where counseling services were sought, but a custody evaluation was performed. I don't know to what degree. I am not a psychologist, so I don't know to what degree it met standards of a custody evaluation. However, a letter was provided to the court with a recommendation that would give a non-psychologist the appearance that a custody evaluation was done and this determination would be valid based on that. As a result, I think that this probably had a tremendous impact on RJ and probably a tremendous impact on DJ. And I am concerned about that. I'm also concerned about the articulation of and attempt to justify this as a bogus complaint, if you will, by the nature of information that is not even pertinent to the case. So to be unable to objectively move forward with counseling even because of a news article that you saw should have probably been caught way before all of this. But not only did the doctor use a news article to render a quite significant recommendation to the court, but the news article had no basis in any of the facts of the services that were being provided. There was perhaps some prejudice or preconceived ideas that were derived from the news article. And that to me is a different level of a safety concern. This isn't somebody who accidentally put on there that this wasn't an evaluation, but I accidentally used the word evaluation. I mean, this is somebody that solely derived the results from reading a news article and then saying, well, this must mean that this person is a bad person. And because of that, I am going to protect this child by rendering this decision. And it's not sitting easy with me or well with me. So I will open it up to my colleagues on the board for additional discussion. Dr. Catarino.
I just want to refer you to standard of care in these cases, the custody cases. APA provides guidelines, and this does not seem very close to what they suggest or, you know, direct you to do.
And I will note for the record that it is noted both in our documentation and in previous discussions that Dr. Olshan states that this was not a custody evaluation and that he was never performing custody evaluation duties. And that was not the intent of any of these services. He was just providing counseling. And so I think that's, I agree with you, Dr. Catarino, in that there are standards to follow and that this didn't probably meet those standards. But I think my concern is that this documentation we have before us indicates that this was never intended to be a custody anything, and that he doesn't understand why it was used as such, but that's on mom, you know, that's on mom. Mom should have never even turned it into the court or used it as such.
Well,
and I think that's where my concern is.
Well, I see that, but the title of the report was that, and it was used, the word evaluation was used also in the body of the report.
I agree. Additional comments, Dr. Ma.
Yeah, I think I was part of the CSC and, you know, we raised many of the same concerns there. It's really unfortunate that Dr. Ocean is not here for the whole board to question him and kind of, you know, so I'd like to just, you know, maybe make a motion that we move it to an informal interview and subpoena Dr. Ocean to be present and address all of these issues. The phone logs that were submitted, I cannot tell. I kept looking at it. I've been looking for a separate file, but I cannot tell what they mean, whether it was scratched out. It's just, I want to see, you know, the records from the phone company, you know, which is what we're used to now. That's the new standard of information, not some those old-fashioned carbon copied kind of things. Which you can do after the fact, because that should be a record when you use your phone. You know, every number is recorded. So I'd like to move it, to make a motion to move it to an informal interview.
And sure. For quick clarification on that, that would be with the inclusion of a subpoena to Dr. Olshan, is it possible at this point to also subpoena the phone records? I mean, do we need to wait to hear about it, or do we have enough evidence to go ahead and subpoena the phone records?
You would have enough evidence to subpoena the phone records.
Okay. So Dr. Malat, that would be my only friendly amendment, is that
okay.
Okay. So we have a motion. I think Ms. Galvin.
One thought, given the history, and Ms. Michelson may have input into how long it might take to get the records. But the notice of informal interview will go out fairly soon. Do you want to instruct staff, given the history, whether to grant any requests for a continuance? I would imagine he's entitled to 35 days notice for an informal, but we might go beyond that because of the subpoena to the phone company. So that would be more than enough time to hire an attorney, have the attorney get up to speed. So is there guidance to whether staff would grant a request for continuance absent emergent circumstances?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart, I believe you seconded that. Were you okay with the amendments?
I second the amendment added to it as well.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Any?
Mr. Wynn had his hand up at
that. Oh, sorry, Mr.
No, I saw your hand go.
Dr. Meyer.
Thank you. So do we need to identify potential violations to forward it, or?
Yes, you do.
Okay, maybe.
So I'd like to point out a few things before we vote on the motion.
Okay, go ahead, Dr. Meyer.
So I'm very concerned about, first of all, the lack of parental consent. The consent form is for treatment, and it's only signed by mom. And there's no evidence that Dr. Olsham received any records of custody. So he should have proceeded for contact with DJ before starting services. So record keeping is a problem here. In addition, as you all have pointed out, the back and forth between saying he's doing treatment versus writing the letter as a titled psychological evaluation, but also making custody recommendations, makes it a custody evaluation. Like, whether that's what he put forth for any person to that would see that and understand it, they would see that as a custody evaluation. So there's also practicing incompetently, and then, yeah, so record keeping, consent, not practicing within the standards of care, are the ones that jump out to me.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. Should that be part of the motion?
Yes, please. Jennifer, do you have statutory sites to that?
I'm sorry, what, Jean?
To record keeping, lack of informed consent, practicing below the standard of care?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I didn't give that. So, first of all, 16E is gross negligence in the practice of a psychologist. And then G, engaging or offering to engage as a psychologist in activities not congruent with professional education, training, and experience. And in reference to that, he talked about he doesn't typically work with kids. And then that shows based on the lack of consistency throughout this. Failing or refusing to maintain and retain adequate business, financial, professional records. I wonder about making a fraudulent or untrue statement to the board or its investigators in his response to the follow-up emails to the complaint, that he's saying this was not an evaluation and that he was only doing treatment. I don't know. And then O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities that are unprofessional by current standards of practice. R, failing to obtain a client's or patient's informed and written consent. No, sorry, that's to release information.
I believe it was V. The violations are listed on page 9. V is for abandoning or neglecting a client.
Dr. Maya, I was going to add to that. The reason why we stated that is because if you recall, Dr. Olshan stated in his testimony that that as soon as he got this complaint, he immediately stopped services with the child because he didn't want to be involved. He didn't want to be in the middle of all of this.
Got it.
And so the neglect, the argument that he's making is that his decisions were under the basis that he felt there was an immediate danger to the child, that the child's welfare and well-being was at stake, but then just got the letter and was like, dropped the services. So that one was an important one for me, but I wanted to give you some of that context.
Thank you. So yeah, add that too. And then AA, violating a formal board order consent agreement, term of probation. I have concerns about him being under a consent agreement at the time these services were being provided. And I think we need to look further into what he was doing and was he discussing this with under supervision or how this was addressed. And then finally, DD, violating ethical standards, and I'm going to need help finding.
The two that we have, Dr. Meyer, from the CSC were 2.04, the basis of scientific and professional judgments. And again, that came from the notion that the majority of both his testimony, his response to the board, and his rationale for requesting the custody or for noting the custody concerns was because he was aware of a news article related to dad's termination of employment. And then the other one that we had, so it wasn't, here's the child's needs. It was, I saw this news article, therefore I made all these conclusions. And then the second one was the 3.10 for informed consent.
And so then it'd also be the 9.03 informed consent and assessments, and 10.01 informed consent to therapy.
I don't know if he gave any assessments.
Yeah, he talks about giving the brief and giving anxiety.
Oh, yeah.
And he phrased his letter as a psychological evaluation.
Yes. So
regardless of what he did, he portrayed it as an assessment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Meyer, another one that we spoke about that still resonates with me is the gross negligence in the practice of psychology. I think this is, again, this isn't just a typo and it had some and whatever. This was potentially quite damaging. And if this happened across other individuals, I would be quite concerned.
I think I said that, didn't I?
Yeah, he did say it.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Those are all the ones I saw.
We had providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or
yeah, otherwise. We have that.
Okay. Can we get can we have them reread as they've been listed? I don't know, Ms. Michelson or Ms. Galvin, if you guys have.
Jennifer, you can back me up. I have 2061 GHA. O double A D D as it relates to 2.04 and 3.10, 9.03 and 10.01.
So I do not hear E in there, and that's the gross negligence in the practice of psychology.
Yeah, I think he cited O and not E. You can do both.
And H?
I had that.
Okay.
So I think the only one that was missing for me was E. So Dr. Meyer, if you're okay with that. And then, you know, to the point of making kind of misleading statements, and I, this was one that we talked about last time, and I just wanted to, we know the importance of properly citing these as it moves to the next level, you know, so that they can see them. But one that we talked about was C, making or using statements of a character tending to deceive or mislead. And the basis of that one was again around, you know, this response of how he has characterized this news article to now use that to even report to the board justification for all of his reasons. I don't know that I have a preference one way or another of keeping that. I just wanted to make sure that we noted that it was on the CSC's notice for this. And I want to make sure that we properly notice everything.
I agree. I think when he's providing as part of his response to the investigation, he's providing news articles for the father's unrelated job. I'm very concerned about that, and he's using that to excuse his behavior, and it has nothing to do with the assessment or treatment. So I'm fine with that.
So to add C for the time being. All right, Dr. Malott, we did a number on your motion. Are you
I accept all the amendments.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart?
I accept the provisions.
Thank you. All right, we got through that. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying, we don't need a roll call, do we? Okay. All in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. All right. And I don't know if DJ jumped up. DJ, thank you for joining us. Board staff will be in contact with you on what the next steps will look like.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Poe. I'm going to go ahead and give out the next CE code word. The next CE code word is toucan. Toucan. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we will now move to agenda item number 10. Ms. Pakanon, can you provide a summary of this agenda item?
Yes, Madam Chair. This item is on the agenda at the request of at least one board member. The questions surround the expectations for appropriate responses to certain questions that we ask both at the time of on the initial application, as well as for renewal of applications. So these questions are intended to capture the applicant's status relative to addiction, impairment. Impairment could be physical, medical, physical, or psychological. And so I've outlined all those questions, provided them to you in the memorandum. So again, we're looking for really some legal advice in terms of, you know, what should we be expecting applicants to answer to those questions, given the unique facts and circumstances that they bring to this their desire to practice as behavior analysts or psychologists in our state. So what we have, we're asking the board to do is, instead of, you know, citing either hypotheticals or even specific examples of which you are aware or instances, that we keep the discussion relatively general. And Ms. Galvin has been briefed on the board's interest in these questions, and so I know she's prepared to speak to them.
Thank you. And just to clarify, you said the seeking legal advice. Is that the request of the board member is to seek the legal advice about these, or is it just a discussion? Just trying to seek clarification. Is it just a discussion of what these items are and perhaps whether or not we need to review if processes or things should change?
Madam Chair, I think it would be the board's pleasure to address either or both of those. I'm looking at the agenda item, and I think it's broad enough that you could probably have both discussions if you would like.
Perfect. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Pakanon related to her summary? Okay. So we can begin the discussion, and I'll go ahead and kick it off and say that, you know, for me, I think one of the, I understand that the intents of these questions are to protect the public. But I also think the answers to these questions can very much be a moment in time. And so because of that, I think that there are considerations that we as a board would need to have related to just basic privacy rights and ensuring that we're not infringing on other rights of individuals. And so that would be kind of my statements on that as that pertains to the topic. Dr. Meyer?
Madam Chair, I don't know how this could be codified in any way. It really feels like these need to be addressed for each individual situation, that there may be extenuating circumstances, there may be information that assuages our concerns, or we may have significant concerns. So I just wouldn't want to put into place any conditions that limit our options to make an individual decision.
Yeah, I think, Madam Chair, I'm one who brought this up, but the question is, you know, for me, we ask these questions on the application. Are they simply us just, and it's phrased in such, and this is why I think I asked for Ms. Galvin's opinion on this, was it's phrased in such of like, do you have a situation that could impair you from practicing, whether it's on the behavior analyst application or the psychologist application? And it's essentially can be checked as a no if you are in treatment for that, or if you decide not to disclose it, and then we find out later that through other mechanisms, through a complaint or something, that there is someone who has been in treatment. And so the question really becomes, is it even relevant at application? Or is it something that, you know,
because of the way it can be answered and then justified why they've answered it as a no, because they don't have a situation where they feel like they're putting the public at risk because they're in treatment, then is it even worth having there is really what I was driving at, because it doesn't seem to capture anything. It's a non-question the way that we address it. So that's kind of what I wanted Ms. Gavin to talk to us about is, do we need it going forward or not? What is it? What's the purpose of that question? What really action do we have around that question? What are we trying to drive home with that question? So
Dr. Davey, if I may, I think the biggest part of that question that may be getting missed is, do you have something that may impede your ability to practice? And I think stigmatizing treatment is extremely challenging, because if we scare the licensees or the public or anybody into thinking that that you'll be shamed or penalized or potentially punished for seeking treatment, or that others will know and be watching, I don't know that equates to the same when this is saying, do you have anything that may impede practice, as far as something that later on, if we find out that they knowingly, like perhaps are being advised to reduce a workload or being advised, and they answer no to that question, I think they're two very different things. I think simply treating, especially, you know, and this could be a medical condition, this could be anything, but I think about the where it's already stigmatized in mental health conditions, simply seeking treatment for your mental health condition, I don't think warrants the disclosure. And I think that's where I stand on, is that language of, is there something that may impede your ability to practice, shouldn't come with, because you're seeking treatment, then that innately impedes your ability to practice. We want to encourage people to manage their conditions. We want to encourage people, to manage. Again, I'll reiterate it with mental health, but I think this could be medical, this could be anything. We want to encourage them to manage it, not discourage it. And yeah, it could be something used in a later, maybe, you know, at a later time or whatever, but I feel like this is almost like a gotcha. And I would venture to say that long-term, this could be viewed as stigmatizing, that even moves very talented professionals away from licensure entirely, because they've battled a condition that perhaps they currently are managing through, you know, medications or therapies or what have you. To me, it goes back to in that moment in time. I think you can have a mental health condition that is very well managed and have a moment in time that changes that. And I don't think it is, one, our role as a board to monitor that, but two, I really worry, I have a child with a mental health diagnosis, and I really worry that this further stigmatizes that. I don't think treatment and impairment to practice are one and are synonymous.
Can we just hear what Ms. Sure. Galvin has as far as a legal opinion, why we have it? I think that'd be helpful.
And just in general, numerous, if not all, licensing boards have a question similar to this, and it was heavily litigated in 2014, and the Department of Justice was involved, and it had to do with Louisiana and the Supreme Court there and the admission into the bar. And the matter was settled, but the courts have stated that licensing agencies have to focus on the conduct of an individual, and it's improper for licensing agencies to focus on the mental or a diagnosis, whether it's mental health or medical diagnosis and or the treatment, but whether the conduct that individual has engaged in would warrant a denial of a license or an investigation or some type of, you know, practice limitation or monitoring. And you have to be sure that the conduct that is engaged in is allowing the practitioner to practice safely and within standards. And you can't screen out, using these questions, you can't screen out individuals or class of individuals based upon a mental or based upon a diagnosis or treatment. So when this decision came down in 2014, there in at least in Arizona with our licensing agencies, every agency's application and questions went under review to ensure that they were in compliance with this federal court litigation and investigation.
So as I, Ms. Galvin, as I understand, this isn't asking whether you're receiving psychological services by any means. What this is asking is, are you impaired, which we would want to know, or are you limited in your ability, which we as a agency would want to know. So it's very narrow in what we're asking, it feels like, and those would be pertinent questions to their ability to provide service. Is that not kind of what it's leading to?
Right. It would be based on the individual's conduct and not a diagnosis or treatment.
Right. And it's,
and I don't know if we've had individuals respond, you know, in the affirmative to any of these, but I certainly know that individuals have contacted the board, licensees have contacted the board and say, you know what, I'm not in a good place right now. So I'm going to, you know, put my license on an active status or whatever. So they are aware of that obligation. And it's not because of treatment, whatever, they understand that they are impaired for whatever reason. And they have notified the board. And that's what we are looking for is conduct, not the fact that they have a diagnosis or are seeking treatment.
Thank you.
So the question is good as it stands right now?
It is.
Okay. So, I mean, the key that I've always focused on is the last spot practice, you know. You know, it's really interesting, limitability, you know, sometimes... say you're having surgery, you know, very general, you're not able, so you close your practice or whatever. Do you have to inform the board just because you're having surgery? I mean, that kind of gets, you know, it's kind of interesting how the, you know, looking at the question.
I mean, there are ethical obligations that would address that a psychologist has the obligation to
inform clients
and take care of themselves, self-care, ensure that, but I would think, you know, be off for 4 months because, you know, whatever, a hip replacement would not require notification.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
And I think that, you know, what Dr. Davis-Wilson's comment is, I think as a board, we want it. You know, we want to encourage people to get help if they need to, whether you're a psychologist or not a psychologist, whoever you are. And that's important. But I think with any jobs, even if you're driving, if you're impaired, right, because you got a license, but if you're impaired or something, you shouldn't be driving. So, again, I think that's where the question is it has to do with the impairment and the ability to practice.
Ms. Peckman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'm hearing the board say, and I just want to put this on the record, both to remind the board and also for purposes of informing the public. This, what I'm hearing is consistent with the spirit with which that you approved the RAMP program, which is the voluntary confidential rehabilitation and monitoring program that both behavior analysts and psychologists can contact board staff for purposes of having evaluating eligibility for that type of program. And we do have information about the program on the website for anyone who's interested. And it's the acronym is RAMP, R-A-M-P.
Ms. Packenham, I have to leave before I scheduled something at noon in the hopes that we would be done. So you still have a quorum, so I'm going to
thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Bye, Dr. Malott. So as far as action on this agenda item, I am clear with Ms. Galvin's feedback that she has provided. I appreciate the overview of the Department of Justice and the 2014 case as well. Any last comments or thoughts?
No, just thank you, Ms. Galvin, for the clarification. And you know, I think it's helpful to kind of have the history behind it. And sometimes we look at it and after the fact when something comes to us. And so it just kind of, it was just beginning to just, I was pondering why. And so I appreciate the background. Thank you.
There's one nugget from a case that I think is instructive, that these licensing agencies need to focus on whether the condition has manifested in conduct that could warrant denial, an investigation, or some type of monitoring. So has the conduct or has the condition manifested itself in conduct that you should be concerned with?
Thank you. I think that's great clarification. All right, we don't have an action on this item. It was for discussion. Thank you guys very much for the discussion. We will move to agenda item number 11. Ms. Pakanon, would you please provide a summary of this matter?
Yes, Madam Chair. The board directed staff to develop the 2023 calendar of meetings. And once that process was complete, to bring the calendar to a board meeting for purposes of the board directing us which meetings you would like to designate and resume in-person meetings. So we have both the board meeting calendar as well as the committee rotations available. Just as a FYI, committee meetings will still be held virtually unless the board makes a different decision. But the 2023 calendar, you'll see that the board meetings are highlighted in yellow. In the past, I have sort of spoke to a few challenges that we might encounter along the way with respect to scheduling in-person meetings. I've explained that there is a lot of work being done to rooms in the building to replace outdated and in some cases malfunctioning audio-visual equipment. So that is one aspect that we aren't certain of. It may cause displacement of an in-person meeting. Of course, we always have Zoom as a backup plan. So what I have prepared is a budget for 2023 that would support the board meeting in person four times, so essentially quarterly meetings. There are costs associated with having in-person meetings, both travel of eligible board members, and then we do hire DPS off-duty security officers for an extra degree of protection in our meetings. So those costs are just something to contemplate, but again, they're budgeted for in the upcoming year. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions or provide any explanation and just listen to the board's direction in terms of when you want to be together in person. I do think that as a practical matter, I think it's a little dangerous for us to anticipate in the first 4 months of the year that boardrooms or meeting rooms will be available. If I had to guess, the construction and repairs that are happening right now will make the first 4 months pretty impractical. We may want to start just with the month of May.
Okay. And just to clarify, because the composition of the board has changed, this would be to go back to the every other month in person. And so it wouldn't be like expecting monthly in person. We're still proposing the pre-COVID schedule if we were to go in person, which I think was about every other month, unless we knew ahead of time there was a really short agenda. And then sometimes that changed it.
Yes, Madam Chair. I think really anything is on the table for consideration. You could sort of resume that pattern. You could just sort of shift to a, you know, quarterly schedule. Now that you've had so much practice with Zoom and become quite proficient with it, I don't know that, you know, it's necessary for you to have even every other month. But that's the board's prerogative, I think.
Ms. Shreve?
I think... Ms. Pakanon, I think you suggested your quarterly. Is that what you said? Mm-hmm. At least, yeah, quarterly or I would say quarterly be the most. I think quarterly or three times a year. We used to have to do a training one. Do you remember? Do we still have to do that for some kind of training for credit hours or something as a board member?
Madam Chair, Ms. Shreve, so that if you're talking about the required training that the governor's office requires as a condition of, you know, your appointment, I think it has to be completed in the first 12 months of your appointment, okay. Maybe 6 months. That's all online now. So you probably did yours in person.
Yeah, but I think they
now
did.
It's okay. Online and on demand.
All right.
All right. Any additional questions for Ms. Pacnon? Do we have any thoughts on what we would like this to look like? As a reminder, you know, Ms. Pacnon board staff have to work very hard to arrange the rooms, and that work does start now. So we, I'm sure they would appreciate some guidance from us. Mr. Nguyen.
I like the quarterly idea.
Yeah. I agree. I think when we were doing it every other month, we were just doing telephone. And so I do think that this brings like a level of a different circumstance than what we were doing before, because it was in person and then telephonic and then in person and the telephonic. Having continuously improved on our Zoom skills, I do think that it ties together just about everything except the rum cake. So I think we definitely need the snacks and the goodies. Dr. Balat has graciously offered to take over rum cake duties. But I do think there's value and benefit in everybody being together quarterly. And but I also like the Zoom stuff. And my only request as a chair, two-time chair in a row, right? Both times having to pivot to Zoom would be that as we continue with Zoom, that board staff, and I've already kind of prefaced this, board staff just explore some strategies around Zoom etiquette so that we can maximize, one, Zoom's potential, because Zoom has a lot of really neat features and neat reports and things like that. But, you know, we've had... you know, I just think it would be nice to just have, especially for when we're notifying people of attendance. So when we're notifying complainants or we're notifying that they kind of have a little bit of an idea of, okay, you're going to have to mute yourself and unmute yourself when you're called on and show us on, you know, show on the camera and all of the things that we've mastered. People who aren't with us at every meeting may not have mastered yet. So that feedback would be grand. Dr. Stewart.
What about distance travel? I live in Prescott and Dr. Mulott lives in Flagstaff.
Yeah. So Ms. Pacnon can speak to, there is some statutory or rule language to cover some of that. But also, it's my understanding that the hybrid format, so even in person, will not replace the hybrid option. So travel for those out of the Maricopa County area, you would still be able to participate without traveling. You would be missing out on some really good cake though. Mm-hmm. So, but Ms. Pacnon, if you could summarize kind of what that looks like.
Yes, Madam Chair. So currently we have two board members, Dr. Stewart, you're one of them, who are eligible for some travel reimbursement costs. So mileage and in some instances, lodging, perhaps, you know, meals or a partial day of meals or something to that effect. So that is definitely budgeted for. So, you know, you're not expected to incur those costs on your own. However, exactly what Dr. Davis Wilson said, we know that we are going to have to, in order to ensure a quorum and ensure board members can, you know, attend around everything else that they're obligated to do in their lives, we need to have the ability to join a meeting remotely. And I do think, too, that we're going to have parties to, you know, cases or, you know, applicants and so forth, that we're going to have to afford them the same, if you want to call it an accommodation. So there are some best practices that I know other boards are using. They other boards have returned to in person, but they're also offering the remote connection. So staff has had, you know, some conversation around that. And we know that this is something that, you know, we need to become proficient in so that we can offer that and ensure it's successful.
Perfect. That's a great question. And I'm glad we're having this discussion because, like I said, this is, I think, only, what, four of us on this call right now have even attended an in-person meeting. Everybody else, you know, it's been in this holdover. So now's the time to ask those questions. All right. So I think if we are in agreement with maybe pursuing quarterly, keeping Zoom the rest of the time, does that give you for board staff some idea on how you can move forward with the rooms? To the best of your ability, of course, I know.
Certainly, Madam Chair. So we would be looking potentially at, if we start with May, that would be May and then August and then November, which I think is a rum cake appropriate season.
Perfect. Okay. Does anybody have any qualms with them giving that a try? Awesome. As always, board staff, if you need anything from us or you have any questions or something comes up, it sounds like everybody's ready and willing to also be flexible. So just let us know what you guys need.
But Madam Chair, let's be clear. Every season is rum cake season.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, what we may ask from board members is a non-quorum, of course. We may ask you to test an attempt to do a hybrid meeting. So that is potentially where you could contribute to this shift that we would like to make.
Awesome. Sounds great.
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Poe. I'm going to go ahead and give out the next CE code word. The next CE code word is macaw. Macaw. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that I just had to say before we move to the next agenda item, I think that Ms. Poe is really, really stepping it up on these code words because I am actually quite like impressed and I'm trying to figure out what the next one's going to be. All right. Agenda item number 12, discussion consideration regarding behavior analyst recommendation with regard to request of withdrawal of initial application for Caitlin Arnold. Ms. Pakanon, can you please provide an overview for the board?
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Arnold applied for a behavior analyst license, but in doing so, she selected the universal recognition application type. And of course, one of the requirements for universal recognition licensure is to establish proof of having Arizona residency. And what the Committee on Behavior Analysts observed when conducting the substantive review of the application is that Ms. Arnold, not only did she not provide evidence of residency in Arizona, she indicated in her application she had no intention of doing so. She applied merely for purposes of providing some assistance to her employer, but not she was unwilling and had no plans to actually move to Arizona. So the committee's recommendation to the board, which is standard in these instances, is to recommend a denial of the application, but allow the applicant the opportunity to withdraw the application. That offer is made to applicants to enable them to circumvent some unintended consequences in the form of adverse action, action that's reportable to the National Practitioners Data Bank. So in many cases, virtually all cases, the applicant is grateful for that opportunity to withdraw. In the case of Ms. Arnold, we had to make multiple attempts to obtain any answer or clarity from her relative to where she wanted her application to go. Finally, we learned from her that she no longer needs this license in Arizona. And what I'm asking the board to do is to please construe that response as a request to withdraw, because again, the only alternative would be to deny the license. And so that question is before you for a decision.
Do we have any questions for Ms. Peckman? Hearing none. Do we have, Dr. David, did you want to
speak? No, she did a great job. No, good.
Okay.
Perfect. She did good.
Okay. Any discussion? All right. So I do believe we do need a motion on this, and that would be to accept the documentation as is as a formal withdrawal request.
So moved.
I'll second, yeah.
A second. All in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. All right. We are at agenda item number 15, new agenda items. Any additions? Not hearing any. I believe Dr. Malott suggested one, but that's in the record earlier in the meeting. If board staff could just be cognizant that she did make a request for one, or considered a request for one, but I don't know how serious she was, or if she would have brought it up. Oh, she was serious, of course, but if she would have brought it up here, or if it was just kind of food for thought. So, but I want to make sure it doesn't get missed. Hearing none. Oh, Ms. Peckman.
Oh, Madam Chair, I was just going to say that just a little bit of foreshadowing. So the board is going to see on October's agenda some recommendations for at least some potential statutory revisions to, you know, of course, if that's, if the board wants those to move forward, we would have to secure a sponsor and so forth. But there will also be some proposed administrative rule changes for the board to consider in the near future. So what Dr. Malott suggested in my mind would fit under what we've already planned, which is a review of some issues to consider revisions to.
No. All right. Hearing any others or hearing no others? Agenda item number 16, adjournment. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
I moved.
Second.
I really like you guys too, but it is a holiday weekend. So we do have a motion and a second. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? The motion carries. Thank you, everybody, for your time, and we will see you in a month.
Thank you. Thank you, board staff. Thank you.